Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here it is, a little more than a minute past the hour on this Tuesday, the 12th day of August, 2014. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go to get into the chat room. I'm going there now. Maybe. Kinda. Sorta. Lord, this computer is so old and tired. There I am. Hey, good evening, Anatole, Blue Ape, M. Brandt, M. from L.A., and, of course, inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderator Sparky. Good evening, one and all. More folks will be wandering by as the program progresses. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Also at the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room, you can find the handy-dandy hop-out player. That's great if you're sitting around a PC. If you're on some sort of smart or i or Android or whatever device, we, all of us, based upon prior usage, recommend the apps from Stitcher and or TuneIn Radio, with the gentle reminder, as ever, that any ads you may see appearing via those apps in no wise, no way, shape, form, or fashion, whatso-freaking-ever, supports the ongoing broadcast operations of The Horn. We don't get a penny. And what's more important, if you see some really loathsome ad that makes you go, well, that ain't us either. You know, stuff like ExxonMobil or BP or Amalgamated Poisoning or whatever. You know, fracking now. Whatever's on there. We didn't do it. And we derive no benefit from it. Okie dokie, okie dokie. No, in point of fact, this is an entirely listener-supported undertaking. It ain't a business. It is supported by generous contributions of everything from cents to dollars to whatever people feel capable of sharing in order to keep things going. Generally speaking, we operate via the PayPal button at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. It's easy to find. It's right there on the right-hand side of the page. And there's a contribute page as well, which you can click on, which will also provide you the traditional mail address, which is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, stands for Personal Mailbox. You don't have to write it out. 318 Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V, 25801. And do please remember, checks and money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, but rather The Horn or Head On Communications, something like that, because Boss Man Wayne handles all of that, and I never see it. So that's how that works. We finished. Thank you very kindly to Paul from Parts Unknown, who, as it's his birthday this week. Happy birthday, Paul. And to celebrate, he is putting forward a $50 challenge each evening. And last night we met his $50 challenge. There's a $50 challenge on the table this evening, which also needs to be met. We fell $50 short of our nightly fundraising goal last night. We tried to raise $150 an evening. We raised $100. And we've got a $50 challenge on the table this evening, which means the first $50 that come in get doubled by Paul from Parts Unknown. And then we need to raise another $100 to stay even thus far. So I guess the fundraising goal this evening is $100. No. Well, yeah. Well, I don't know. I get a lot of math, you know, me, math problem. Yes. And there will be another Paul from Parts Unknown challenge tomorrow, which I am proud to announce. Thank you, John. We've got several Johns. This John will know which John he is. Will be met by John, who is using the traditional mail service so to do. So that leaves just tonight's third of Paul from Parts Unknown's birthday challenge to be met. And hopefully that will happen sooner rather than later. No, Tim. Tim from L.A. in the chat room. And for a $2,000 donation to your show, you can have a no expense paid to your home studio. No. ain't enough room in here for two people, trust me. Not at all. This is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, of course, which is a time when we celebrate the Titanic intellect of the right wing. And, oh, Lord, we've got some pretty sorry examples of it this evening, and we'll get to them in short order. You know, usually I filibobster through the first hour. But toward the end of the program last night, I heard from our good friend Tracy, who is, she's gone back to graduate school, or she's gone to graduate school. I don't think this is her second run at graduate school. And the only time she had available for conversating, and we haven't conversated in quite some time, was during this first hour of the program. And she's on the line now. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
Oh, I'm okay, I think. It sounds like you're working the grindstone pretty hard.
Oh, man. I actually had a mini breakdown in my advisor's office. That's how I was texting with you. But we've come up with it. Because it's been a million years since I've been in school, for one thing. And to go from not being in school to going to grad school, because this is not going back to the grad school. This is my first run at it. And then being on the quarter system. And And then being a newlywed and all these things. And not only a newlywed, but being married to a woman that is on a scale of 1 to 10 of needy. She's on the Richter scale. So, I had a slight breakdown. And my advisor is wonderful, because what I'm loving about this school, Bob, is that it is set up so you will succeed. They do not want anybody to fail. It's not like, okay, so what if you don't take your classes or if you mess up? We still have your money. Keep it moving. It is quite the opposite, so much so, because I have all these papers due, and I started 2 out of 8. And they're like, 5-6-page papers. Again, I am far from a stupid person. But when it comes down to organizing my thoughts and putting them on paper, not so much. So the school is going to pay for a tutor for me for an intensive writing course for me for 4 hours every other Saturday, and then a weekly session at our regular writing center during the week.
Very nice. Very nice indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, that will... And you know what? You'll crawl right up that learning curve probably quicker than you can even imagine. There's nothing like having to do it to make you do it.
Right. And, I can write, Bob. I can. I just don't like it. And a lot of it stems from when I was in high school and I had a white teacher tell me, because I was in honors English, tell me that, I was an affirmative action ad. In so many words, that I was taking up the space of some really white boy or
some,
girl.
Yeah, some deserving white person. Oh, Jesus.
Right. And so it is amazing when you are a person that's, it wasn't like I was raised to be deferential to white people, but I was. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. So, of course, I never questioned. Of course, I never said anything to my mother. Had I said anything to my mother, she would have went up there and snatched and ripped him a new one. But I believed her. And because I believed him, that followed me for 30 some odd years of my life. I would go to, Friday for a class when I was in college, on the numerous occasions that I've been in and out of school, and I would get the syllabus on the first day, and if it said anything, I could get away with just writing a regular paper or writing, like, essay questions or, answers for essays for tests.
Right.
But when it came down to, like, a research paper, if it said anything about a research paper, I dropped the class. I absolutely dropped the class.
That sounds like me in math classes. Yeah, you're talking to the guy who skated through up at Harvard on the Mon by taking, because, and it was right before they changed everything. Now at WVU, I think English majors actually have to take calculus, which would make me a non-college attending person.
Calculus? I know statistics, but not calculus?
Yeah, oh yeah. I think everybody has to take it now.
Yeah.
But no, I took having taken a run at algebra and realizing that it just was not going to take once again. I somehow or another I finagled my way into a class called Math 23, Introductory Concepts in Mathematics. It was a really
good... You even remember the name of the class.
You
wow.
Damn right, because you know what? This was during the golden age of West Virginia football under Don Nealon, and me and the West Virginia University Mountaineer football team took Math 23 together. I mean, there were some cool guys in there. We're talking the 440 the 4440 guys.
Oh wow!
And so in Math 23, Introductory Concepts in Mathematics, we were taught by a mathematics PhD. No kidding, no graduate assistant for us. And he was a fan. And he would he did every. He just wanted us to understand that math was a thing. That was his goal. And so we did really cool things like learning to count with the Mayan numerical system. And
what?
Yes. And we watched a magnificent documentary called Mickey and Donald Go to Math Magic Land.
Shut up.
And our final exam was multiple choice, and I fulfilled my mathematics requirement and got my happy little Bachelor of Arts.
Wow. That's wow. Well, here at Antioch, the cool thing is, they don't do testing because they feel that it doesn't, anybody can regurgitate, what different tests they said on a test, but they want to make sure you know what you're talking about. So we have, a lot of writing. But what I like about it is, it's so funny because 2 weeks ago we had to do a take-home writing assessment and a math assessment. And I did pretty darn well on the math assessment other than ratios and mixed fractions. And the geometry part, I just crossed off and said, what the hell?
Yeah.
And I actually wrote, what the hell? Why do I care? I don't care.
Well, I mean, I was the little smart-ass geometry student who, when presented with a right triangle that had legs of X, Y, and Z. No, legs,
mm-hmm.
X, Y, and Z. And,
right.
And X was... Z was labeled 4 and Y was labeled 3 or whatever. And the question was find X, and I drew an arrow to the letter X and circled it. Here it is.
Well, basically that was my thing. So they've come to the conclusion, that math is not, I'm stronger in math than I expected. But my advisors said, well, here's the deal, Ms. Porter. If you want to become a grown-up psychologist, which I do, I said, I know I'm going to have to take statistics. I already know this. I'm just going to get the maximum strength volume for it, and we're going to get through this. Because I'm going to have to learn how to deal with statistics if I want to be a psychologist. But the cool thing about here is, I don't know, the way they teach, you will learn. And it won't be a terrifying experience. I feel you on the math, buddy. I do. I really, really do. But according to my testing, I'm smart. On the
was
scale
that,
of 1 to
5. Was that ever in doubt?
No. It was just,
okay, just checking.
Well, they're smart like I am, and then they're academically smart, you know what I'm saying, or testing smart, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's different levels of what people consider smart.
Absolutely. And you know what? Testing smart is different from learning smart.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those people who always tested very well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a different
but
thing.
But you're smart.
Well, it's a different thing, though, if you ask me to do that at 8 o'clock in the morning.
No. No, it's not.
See, all those math classes, for some reason, every time I tried to sign up for one, they rolled the dice and they told me that I had to take it at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I just, this is not going to happen.
I'm not awake. If you want me, first of all, to be awake and understand what you're talking about, and I don't know, are you a coffee person?
Was. No, I was such a coffee person that I abused it so thoroughly that, that I had to go to decaf in January of 1996. It just about blew my little heart up.
Well, Janet is a coffee person. I remember one night I was out working, and she called me. And she said, "You're out of coffee." And she said, "Yeah, you know, that's okay. You don't have to get it. I'll get it." I said, "Oh, hell no. Oh, no, 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 no. You are not going to be roaming around and screaming and growling in the morning because you don't have your coffee. I will go to the store. I don't care how tired I am. I will go to the store and get your coffee. You're not going to put me in that situation. No way, no how." No, my girl was not the most, she is truly a coffee person. She is not nice. Without her coffee. I purposely stay in bed in the morning until she's had at least her second cup. And then I come out of the room because, you know, you got to duck and, you know, duck and roll and shit.
Yeah.
She has her coffee. I don't, but anyhow, but back to, let's see, who's the craziest today? I saw your tweet about the gentleman who said that Robin Williams is a coward.
Yeah, that would be Shepard Smith of Fox News, Radio
okay,
Rwanda, Fox News TV, Radio Rwanda.
Well, see, here's the deal, and, you know, I've shared my story with my foreign family about depression. And I've battled with it for years to the point that I had thoughts of suicide. I actually had plans on how I would kill myself. Okay. Fortunately, I got the help that I needed. And the dark thoughts, while they are still there, they don't last quite as long, and I fight my way through them. And that's another reason why I'm loving being at Adioc. Because they take all that into consideration. As long as you let somebody know that you need help. We even have a counseling center on campus. And there, I mean, I'm going to get my, you know, of course, it's the student that I'm finishing up the master's program in psychology. And the only difference between a licensed quote unquote, licensed psychologist or regular psychologist and the students here is that they just don't have all their hours. That's it. So I'm going to start going to counseling and drag that along kicking and screaming if I have to. But will you feel that there is no hope when the bottom has fallen out and it takes every fiber of your being just to breathe. I'm not even talking about moving, Bob. I'm talking about just to get enough going that you can breathe. I know how that feels. And for this son of a bitch to sit on, you know, sit on high and look down on us humans and say that this man was a coward, how dare you? It took everything I had.
Well, see, I'm a mean person, and my first thought with regard to Shepard Smith was, what a pity you're not as big a coward.
Yeah. You know, these people who feel
But the other thing I immediately thought of was, you remember in the aftermath of September the 11th, 2001, when Bill Maher still had that program on ABC?
Oh, yeah.
Politically Incorrect.
Yeah.
And he said, call the September 11th bombers anything you wish to, but do not call them cowards. Because that it was not cowardly.
No.
And he lost a job out of that. Now, granted, he fell in poop and came up smelling like a rose, but, you know.
Right, you know. But it's true. It's like the kamikaze pirates in World War II. Do you know that what you're about to do, you're doing this in spite of knowing that you are going to die? You don't have a death wish. You are a true believer.
Yeah.
You are willing to give up your life for a cause, for a situation. These are not cowardly people. I took a workshop Saturday on art and suffering. And so we were seeing pictures of photojournalists taking pictures of, war and death and destruction. I mean, so we started off with early 1800 artists who actually drew pictures of, you know, like when they executed soldiers by hanging, you know, the enemy by hanging and castration and, you know, stuff like that. And we followed the history from, you know, painting to the early photography to now. And how you can see the art and the beauty in somebody's in death. But, you know, you see these people, these suicide bombers and all these people who are willing to risk their lives. Like they had this one picture of a man, it was a Hispanic man, who was killed. Well, he used murder. It's so funny. As I go along in my education, how words, the way somebody writes or says something, they didn't just say this man was killed. He was murdered because he was trying to fight for the right. He was a striker for at a sugar company or something down in Mexico in the early 50s. But he knew that when he left his house that morning, he probably knew that he was going to die, but he left anyway. And and what made me think about it is, do we have anybody anymore that is willing to die for their belief? I look at, you know, during the civil rights movement and all this, you know, and the marches and stuff. And the people who came, the freedom riders who came down from the north and different parts of the country so people could have their government given right to vote down south. And they knew that they could die. But they said, you know what? If I die, I die, but this is not right and we have to do something about this. Do you think anybody has that kind of gumption anymore, Bob?
Not in this country? No. Very few. And
very few.
Well, on the one hand, that's a good thing. On another hand, I don't know. If you try to, for instance, engage in a hunger strike in a in some portion of America's prison industrial complex, the minute you say that, they strap you down and start intravenously feeding you against your will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, occasionally we will have some Second Amendment gundamentalist who will shoot up a bunch of people and then shoot himself. It's almost always a him. But the people driven by ideological, well, you know, we had the story of the septuagenarian pastor from Texas who immolated himself not too awfully long back. And there's a, you know, there's a big difference between doing that as an act of protest or an act of defense of others, such as what happened with, and you know, it's the 50th anniversary and everything, the three freedom riders who were murdered by the Klan in Mississippi 50 years ago. There's a big mm-hmm. difference between that and making a decision to end one's own life.
Exactly.
I kind of have some halfway prepared remarks on this. Odd thing is, I sat out to write about it this morning, and then Facebook made it disappear, which teaches me to always draft in a word processing program first if it's something that matters to me.
Yeah. I've learned that lesson the hard way, too.
But it occurs, what I don't like, and I'll say this straight up, and Robin Williams is providing the vehicle for this discussion, unfortunately. I really wish we were talking about Dick Cheney's suicide.
Yeah, you know, all the people that I wish would die.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Boner.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't...
There's that old gag about out there about the guy who walks by the newsstand every morning and pays for a newspaper, reads the front page, folds it up. He hasn't even looked inside. And sets it back down on the stack. He's basically just paid the newsstand owner for the right to read the front page. And this happens and happens and happens and happens, and the guy finally says, "Hey, buddy, you always buy a newspaper from me, and then you look at the front page and you put it back. Why? Why don't you even keep the paper?" The guy goes, "Oh, I'm just looking to see if somebody's dead." He goes, "But you don't even look to the obituaries." And he says, "No, no, no. The son of a bitch I'm looking for will be on the front page." But the larger point here, and I'm in kind of a unique position, Tracy, because I get, as I've mentioned on a number of occasions, all kinds of pitches every day for people being offered up as expert guests for your program.
Oh, Jesus.
And it started last night. I made the announcement on air, and then within an hour's time, I already had the first pitch in my inbox. Noted psychologist can explain to you why suicide happens. And then it goes into talking about depression, and it talks about mental illness, and it talks about recognizing signs. And okay, so we're going to do that on Robin Williams' back. Well, I've probably got a half a dozen more today. Offering experts to tell your audience about suicide, and it's all offered under the guise of public service. But it's not. It's some dude hustling a book. And I find it creepy and pretty disgusting.
Morose,
yeah. See, art of knowing words, right there at work. But more than anything else, it is mercenarily capitalistic.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, look, dude's dead. And the PR flack is going, well, I think I can get him on at least a half a dozen radio stations, and that means we might sell 27 books, and... Yuck. So...
You're a vulture.
Yeah, it is vulturine. But, and I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, and I'm not trying to engender a debate about this, but I really, 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 Tracy, believe in the fundamental freedom of choice.
Exactly.
We talk about the freedom of choice of children to go to the school of their choosing. We talk about a woman's right to choose what to do with the workings of her own body and I mean to take nothing away from anything by saying this, but if at the end of the day a person's very life is not his or her own, with the choice of when and if to end it, then how free are we?
How free are we? It's like those people who are dying.
And
they won't let them pick you off. Assisted suicide is against the law. Why?
Why is Dr. Kevorkian still in prison?
Exactly.
Or is he dead?
I thought he died. Somebody in the chat room will Google and let you know.
But there are a couple of questions. Yeah, he died back in 2011. Sorry. There are a couple of questions that attend this sort of thing. Is it always? Is any person who chooses to end his or her own life always, by definition, mentally ill or depressed?
No, I don't think so.
If a person a 15-year-old boy or girl who has been bullied into suicide, that's not suicide. That's homicide, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That is a form of homicide. But if a person is 50, 60 years old and has lived a full life and makes a decision that now is the time to go, go.
If you feel, like I said, on the substance of suicide in my own case, I fought it, and I completely and deeply understand feeling the way when you just feel like you have absolutely no hope, and it's just you don't even have the energy to breathe. Unfortunately for me, I fought my way back, and I thought the main thing I did was thought about what it would do to my son. And so you have
in that instance, Tracy, you knew to fight it.
I knew to fight it.
We act like, and this is the hubris of our culture, this culture. We act like we are the final word on what is acceptable and what is not. But there are myriad cultures all over this planet that have included suicide as a viable solution. Stockton Larry in the chat room just posted a quote from the Roman philosopher Seneca, who said, "Taking your own life is your final civil right. I will not allow any government or religion or other authority to deny me."
Done. And done.
Yeah.
That is your final, when people say you have a right to life, these rights to life, why don't I have a right to die? Why don't I have, as long as in my death, when I take my own life, I don't take anybody else with me?
Well, that's because they're a bunch of religiously motivated, zealot jackasses. Because only God can give life, and only God can choose when to take it. No.
And I'm a Christian, so no. Because
we're talking about a God that offed his own kid.
Yeah, come on. And so Abraham to off his. So come on, players, get a clue. We are, but again, even in Christianity, if you're truly following Christ, you have, it's free will. You have the right to choose as to whether or not you want to be a Christian or not. It's just that simple. We're not, unlike what some of these fundamentalists and all these crazy, white wingers are saying that, everybody has to be a Christian. This is a Christian country. It is not. It is it's not. You know, I get into some heavy debates with my mom about, you know, she's like, well, if we still have prayer in schools, all this wouldn't happen. I said, Mom, when prayer in schools were mandatory, if we were living down south, you wouldn't have even had a decent school.
Yeah.
When prayer in school was mandatory, segregation was king. I said, you're praying, talk about praying to the same God that, you know, that these people felt like believed in segregation.
What do you do when when everybody's praying to the same God, but half the people are praying, please, dear Jesus, keep them out of our good, godly Christian schools, and the other side's praying, please, dear Jesus, deliver us from bondage?
Exactly.
I mean, what is Jesus flipping a coin?
It's like, okay, who do I like more? It's like when you watch those movies and, you know, before the football game, the big game, and they're praying to God to, you know, take out their opponents and stuff. It's like, dude, first of all, it's just a game. I know, do not strike me down about football. I understand you guys get real deep into it. I love it when you and Sandra talk about football, and I'm just sitting there listening going, I have no idea what the hell they're talking about. I just like, okay, you know. But I love the passion. I love the passion in the conversation. But it's just when I could tell you right now, I was devastated. Because the first time I heard about Robin Williams dying, because I was working all day, is when who were you talking to? Bill? Who were you talking to before Bill?
That was Edward. That was Edward.
When you said it, and I'm like, what? And so yes, I'm driving, and then I googled it while I was driving. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Hagee was out there lining up with Lennon.
You know, and then I read Robin Williams died, and then to find out that he hung himself. Oh. That.
Oh, and by the way, via my good friend on Facebook, Carol Baker, who is a radio talent in her own right, and folks should follow her on Facebook, she pointed
Carol
out
Baker.
Carol Baker. She pointed out.
Is that Carol with the E? I'm sorry, is that Carol with the E or the C?
No, that's just Carol Baker.
Okay.
She pointed out that when the Marin County Coroner's Office had their presser, the rotten bastards gave the family's address.
Excuse me, what?
Yeah, they gave the Williams home address. And then last night, as the Williams family had issued a very simple call for respect for privacy, some godforsaken for-profit media, News Channel Eyewitness Team Coverage Now, whatever, had a goddamned helicopter hovering over their home.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Where is Nero and his fiddle? Because Rome is fucking getting ready to burn.
Well, and meanwhile, and I feel kind of really shiny white privilege-y about this. I'm spending time talking about this while in Ferguson, Missouri, a young man who was ready for his first day of college.
Oh no!
Got gunned down by the police.
And
unarmed and unthreatening.
And what was the reason?
Oh, I thought he was going for a gun. Well, he was clearly all reaching for the officer's gun, which is the kind of shit you make up after the fact. But you know what? No coverage, no coverage, no coverage. But the community becomes outraged, and a few people go and loot a Rippy Mart, and suddenly, rioting in St. Louis suburb! Black people gone wild.
But we don't talk.
You know, maybe if the cops would quit summarily executing people, people wouldn't be so upset. And then I'm on Facebook earlier today, and I find video of a CHP trooper beating the snot out of a black woman. I mean, just repeatedly punching her in the head over and over and over again. You know, with his little motorcycle gloves and shit on. And people were slowing down to video this because it was just sickening.
Yep.
Repeated blows. Had her on the ground, on her back, repeatedly punching her in the head.
There's no way to justify that.
No.
Once she was subdued and in handcuffs, he hadn't cuffed her yet, but once he had her down on the ground, only that he had, because she was not resisting. Once he got her down on the ground, okay, she's like, I'm done. Mary was going, and the thing is, yes, she should not have been walking on the freeway. Okay. But you don't deserve a beat down for walking on the goddamn freeway. You know, I'm sorry. People, like somebody, you know, I guess it was those people who say, and of course these are the white privileged people who say, why are you black people still whining? You have a black president. Racism is over. And to that I respond, no, racism is worse than it has ever been because, it's, you know, back before we had a black president, the shit was hell, you know, was down on the DL. You felt it, you knew it, but people had the common courtesy and sense to keep that shit toned down. Okay? But then when we elected Barack Hussein Obama, the hoods came off, the teabaggers came out, and white people, for the most part, lost their motherfucking mind. I mean, I know white people who were lifelong Democrats. I mean, have been voting Democrat since Skip was a goddamn pup. And as soon as the brother got the nomination for the president of the United States, they walked away.
You don't have to tell. You're not telling me anything, Tracy. Because see, I remember the 2008. I think it was May the 23rd, Democratic primary in West Virginia when Hillary, Barack Obama already had the nomination. It was over, and Hillary just bumped him. And afterward, interviewing the Democrats, I think, they found all. I didn't. Now these are registered Democrats in West Virginia. I didn't want to vote for somebody with a Hussein name. We ain't ready for a Muslim president. And then, I'm just not ready to vote for one of those people for president. I don't think the country's ready. No, believe me, I know. And then, of course, there was the 2012 presidential election, when Barack Obama was beaten in several counties in the West Virginia primary by a felon who was incarcerated in the state of Texas. Not kidding. And so now in 2014, lo and behold, Shelley Moore Capito and Evan Jenkins and some dude from Maryland named Mooney are bringing in, no, really, because he has so much in common with working West Virginians, Bishop Willard Romney, to talk about how if only we'll send Republicans to the Senate and the House, that West Virginia will have prosperity and they'll be able to stop Obama's war on coal. I kid thee not. We're bringing Willard here. I'll have one of those beans and a cornbread, if you don't mind.
Mittens? They rolled out Mittens?
Yeah, they're rolling out Willard, the bishop. Flying all the way in from Kolob, baby.
Well, you know they had lost their minds of course, Mittens is a fucking Mormon. So when you see a full-page ad in the L.A. Times on election, like this is the day before Election Day or Election Day in 2012, with the Right Reverend Billy Graham saying that to keep America America, we need to elect Willie Romney. And I laugh my ass off because I know how those rednecks down in the Bible Belt feel about Mormons. Well, Christians in general.
Yeah.
So, you know.
No, you don't have to. You don't have to speculate. You know, Pastor Robert Jeffress of the big old Baptist church, first big old Baptist church in Dallas, Texas, said Romney's a member of a cult. Really? Mm-hmm. You know, he said that. But no, you know. I would love it if somebody went to the appearance and said, tell us about Kolob, Bishop. Tell all these Christians about Kolob and how Jesus and the devil are brothers. Tell them. Read to us from the original Reformed Egyptian, Bishop.
See, this is how I knew when it came, I always knew this country was racist. I always knew it. I mean, and the more I study our history, the more evident it becomes, especially when after the Civil War and they had that brief shiny moment called Reconstruction, and then the federal government fucking bailed and left the black people to their own devices. What did they think? Did they really think that the white folks would just say, you know what? We're tired of all that fussing and fighting and whatnot and so forth. Let's all be, you know, let's all sit around the camp fucking fire and sing Kum motherfucking Faya.
Mm-hmm. Nah, it didn't happen, did it?
They left these people, they left them alone. And then we go from slavery to Jim Crow.
Thank you, Plessy versus Ferguson.
Exactly. And then after that, how many years before we got Brown versus the Board of Education? How many years did that take?
What was that? 1954.
Okay, and then how many years after that did we get the Civil Rights Act? 1960 what?
10 years later.
Okay. So from 1897 to when did Reconstruction?
Well, they gave up on Reconstruction in the late 1860s, early 1870s.
Okay. And then after that.
And then Plessy versus Ferguson comes along in 1896.
Okay.
And that's what enshrines
separate
but equal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though, oddly enough, the Supreme Court said, well, this is a very narrow, limited decision. I mean, this is a decision about railroad cars. You know, kind of the way the Hobby Lobby Court said, well, this is a very narrow, limited decision. It's a decision about closely held personal corporations and their closely held personal beliefs.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I know. Not
so
much.
In any event, I guess I better go to class. But anywho, it was, I miss you guys. It was fun being in the chat room yesterday briefly listening to you. And thank you for that Robin Williams, play, what you did with the Robin Williams thing. That was awesome. Just how he talked about, like you said, about the press correspondent dinner. There's no way in hell.
Mm-mm.
That Robin Williams would have been invited during those 8 years of hell to be the MC of that, because he would have just, was it, if it's right, is that the word? He would have torn Bush to shreds.
Oh, they would have had to carry Dim Leader away in a basket.
In a basket. There would have been nothing left. So, but anyhow, it was amazing as usual. I miss my Horns family. The good news is the quarter will be over in about 4 weeks, and I have a 3-week break in between where I will breathe and recuperate and learn never, ever, ever to take 3 workshops again, because I thought, big deal, one, you know, a workshop, you get a unit and you got to write a paper. You didn't know they were like 10-page papers. okay, so.
Double space?
So once I. Yeah, double space.
You know, spacing is your friend, Tracy.
Yeah, and there's only so many bullshit words you can fill in. I told one of my instructors, I said, it's not that important that I could write 10 pages about the subject without sounding like I'm repeating myself.
No. It's 10 spaces, triple spaced, with 24-point Comic Sans serif font.
Yeah, no, it has to be 12-point.
Oh, they figured it out.
Roman. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. Hey, you want to know how life is around here? Running this little conversation. I just got an email from Randy saying, "Don't make Tracy late."
I'm right off my class. I'm good.
I wish I had a staff. There really is a staff here. I mean, I got people watching clocks. So before I get in trouble with the Horn Family Commune congregation, well, I'll talk to you later, Tracy. Go to class.
Yeah, I'm going to class, and you guys keep it moving. I hope that our next conversation won't still be so few and far between. I will promise I will check in more, but I will, if nothing else, email people and say hi. And you didn't call me today, Bob, that you could. You tied up.
I did. I got kind of wrapped up in stuff, but we got to talk.
Well, like I said, I am available every morning after 8:30.
Okay.
Maybe Friday.
Okay. Good deal.
So
we will because we got to get some stuff cooking on the 8 campaign.
Do. Yes, and I like I said when I forwarded to you, I sent you the thing about our church, the sermon series for this month, and one of the sermons is about our natural resources and water.
Timely. Absolutely timely.
Very timely.
Tracy, don't be late to class. And take an apple.
Apple for the teacher. You guys are funny. Anyway, love you guys, and I will talk to you soon.
All right, we love you, Tracy. You take care, dear.
All right, bye.
Bye now. The lady cab driver, otherwise known as the master's degree candidate, that's our Tracy. It's about 8 minutes before the hour. A lot of email has rolled in. By the way, thanks right off the bat. Thank you. Thanks to Marty for answering a portion of Paul from Parts Unknown's birthday challenge for this evening. And that gets us, he doubled his money, as does anyone who responds to that challenge. Sal also responded and doubled his money. So that means we have $25 more to double in order to finish up Paul from Parts Unknown's birthday challenge for this Tuesday, the 12th day of August, 2014. Jessica pointing out, subject line, rational suicide. Those who take a pros-cons approach to decide to end one's life, perhaps a terminal illness, loss of independence, or financial distress where hope of change is not viable or likely, not widely accepted other than in limited medical or hospice circles. And see, I'm not in either one of those circles technically. I'm just in one of these. And when I say personal freedom, I don't think that suddenly this has turned into some sort of libertarian, who is John Galt fest. It isn't. But there are some things. We'll talk more about this out of the break. So with that in mind, let's switch over to Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. It is a Tuesday, therefore that means we have the Green News Report. This is Conversation Radio, listener supported. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
It's Tuesday, August 12, 2014.
If you've been alive, 30 or 40 years or more, you have to realize that the weather patterns you've seen in the last few years are like nothing else before in your history.
If it seems like there's more extreme weather, you're right. Sanctions, sanctions. ExxonMobil begins drilling in Russia's Arctic. Methane rising in the melting Arctic. Plus,
national interest will be served. Only if this project does not significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution.
Oops, looks like the State Department vastly underestimated how much the Keystone XL pipeline will significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution.
All of those significant problems and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
They say there's no global warming, but right now the North Pole is a pool. There's things just floating away, and it is beyond global warming at this point. It is cooking.
Thanks, Robin. I guess we'll take it from here. This is your Green News Report.
It's 105 in the middle of the country, and people come up going, is it hot enough for ye? No, I like sweat to be rolling down the crack of my ass like Niagara.
Okay, Desi Doyen, before we begin, we've got extreme cold in the east, we've got extreme warmth in the west, and so climate deniers will tell you, hey, the temperatures are perfect, absolutely normal, nothing to worry about.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, you know, when you have extreme heat on the one side of the country and extreme cold on the other side of the country, it means the average for the whole country is kind of average.
It's perfect, there's nothing to worry about.
Except, of course, there is. California is seeing off-the-charts record heat this year. We're seeing unprecedented back-to-back hurricanes in Hawaii, record heat waves in Australia, record-breaking storms and biblical rainfall and flooding in Boulder, Calgary, Pakistan, Pensacola, and now in Detroit. If it seems to you like we are seeing more extreme weather events, you're right. That's according to meteorologist Dr. Jeff Masters of Weather Underground in an interview with The Real News.
Starting in about 2010, the atmosphere just got so crazy that a lot of meteorologists, it was a wake-up call for them. They said, hey, you know, something's up. And even the common person, I mean, if you've been alive, you know, 30 or 40 years or more, you have to realize that the weather patterns you've seen in the last few years are like nothing else before in your history.
And now a new study, again, links the increase in extreme weather events to the melting of the Arctic. It confirms previous studies showing that loss of sea ice in the Arctic is warming the air above it. That's slowing down the jet stream, in turn causing extreme swings in global weather patterns. Temperatures in the Arctic have gone up at double the rate of the rest of the world since 2000, and the study's researchers note that the number of extreme weather events has also doubled around the world at the same time. The melting of the Arctic is also releasing methane, a greenhouse gas more potent than carbon dioxide. In a new study, scientists from Stockholm University say they were surprised to find, quote, vast plumes of methane escaping from the sea floor in the Arctic. It's the first study to verify methane bubbles are reaching the surface of the Arctic Ocean. They say more data is needed now to determine how much and how fast the ocean's methane is being released, but they do say this is a really worrisome development.
Surprise, terrible development. Beginning a positive feedback loop that everybody hoped and prayed would never happen, could be happening.
The melting of the Arctic is also opening up vast oil resources, ironically, which is why Russia's President Vladimir Putin is very happy with ExxonMobil. Even though the U.S. has launched economic sanctions against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine, this week ExxonMobil began drilling for oil in Russia's Arctic anyway. Exxon's $700 million partnership with Russia's state-owned oil company Rosneft is not subject to the sanctions because it was signed before the sanctions went into effect.
It's not subject because Barack Obama doesn't want to harm oil interests, specifically American oil interests, if you consider ExxonMobil, anyway, to be an American company.
Very patriotic of them.
Yeah.
Speaking of oil and President Obama, remember when Obama said this about whether he'd approve the controversial proposed Keystone XL pipeline from Canada?
National interest will be served only if this project does not significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution.
Well, a new report calculates that the climate impact of the proposed pipeline could be 4 times greater than that claimed by the U.S. State Department in its environmental assessment report. The Stockholm Environment Institute study finds the State Department did not account for the increase in oil supply that the pipeline would bring to the market. More oil means lower prices per barrel, and that triggers more consumption and therefore more emissions. The study calculates 4 times more emissions, enough to erase emissions cuts from President Obama's plan to cut emissions from power plants.
So that recent landmark EPA plan to reduce emissions by 30% by 2030 from those power plants would be essentially erased if they built this Keystone XL pipeline?
According to this study, yes.
Brilliant. What a mess. For much more on those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can also download us at TuneIn, Stitcher, and iTunes, and we much appreciate and need your five-star ratings at each of them. So thanks in advance for that. Find us and follow us on the Facebook and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
God, that song's one of those guilty pleasures. I love that song. Don't know why. Hey, this is The Horn. It's a Titanic Tuesday on The Horn, and we have Titanic intellects with which yet to deal. But just by way of a little lead-in and a bit of an expansion on that, on what I was talking about with Tracy. Henry David Thoreau said, "Most men lead lives of quiet desperation and go to the grave their songs unsung." I think that's pretty close. I don't think you can say that about Robin Williams. But by God, you can sure say it about a young man from Ferguson, Missouri, who was summarily executed by the police. And therein lies the dichotomy of the last few days. Before the program, Marty reminded me of the line from, is it Song of Myself that the professor is quoting in Dead Poets Society? I sound my barbaric yawp over the rooftops of the world. That's Whitman, isn't it? Yes. I'm just unwilling. Because I'm that free to speculate upon the mental state of a 63-year-old man who chose to end his life. I'm engaging in a little bit of transference because the first person who came to mind when that news came out was Ernest Hemingway. And I spent a lot of time reading Ernest Hemingway's biographies as a younger man because I so admired his writing. And by the time he got to Ketchum, Idaho, he'd been, and he'd had a magnificent life fraught with drama and troubles and more troubles and brilliance and insecurities, you know, all those things that make up the human experience. But it seems that he pretty well saw the writing on the wall and checked out. And so stigmatized with suicide at the time, and we're talking about 1960. He was born on July 1st, 1899 in Oak Park, Illinois. And life had become intolerable for him. And they hospitalized him. And they used electric shock on him. And they did everything that medical science had available to them in 1960 to try to make his urges to die go away. But his daddy had done the same thing, and of course his daddy was a physician and a rational man. And so he did what he did in Ketchum, Idaho. And the question that follows from it is, what would we have someone be? Is there anyone here who's prepared to tell me that TMZ would not have gleefully reported Robin Williams back in rehab? Robin Williams in tutu in San Francisco, speaking in high-pitched helium voice. Robin Williams breaks down in tears. Because the celebrity press preys on this shit. Is there any among us? Well, and by the way, you know, we hear suicide and we go, oh, he must have been mentally ill. What if he knew something nobody else knew? What if he knew there was a little knot of cancer growing inside him and he said, hey, you know what? I don't want to check out in a hotel, in a hospital hotel room with a bunch of shit going ping around me and a bunch of hoses. And as I said to Tracy, why is it that we assume that this culture is the culture that has the answers? Is it because we've got electricity? Is it because we've got little computers we can hold in our hands? It damn sure isn't because we're the most enlightened culture that has ever inhabited the planet. We're not. We watch Duck Damn Dynasty, for Christ's sakes. Most of the people who inhabit this planet never get into the history books. And yet they manage to somehow lead lives of sublime significance no matter what they are doing because they are human. I am anthropophilic and I know it. I'm trying to overcome some of it, but I still am. I'm also a weirdo, okay? Because I've come to the conclusion that if I live to the great age of the mythologic Methuselah, 900 and some odd years, I'd be saying, nah, not long enough. I want to see what comes next. But that doesn't prevent me from looking at someone and saying, well, you know, you did that. It's your right. Why, in the name of God, do we have to look at someone and say, well, you know, this is an excellent chance to talk about mental illness. Oh, sure, mount up on his corpse and ride along. You know, this is a great time to talk about alcohol and drug dependency. Well, I guess there's room for two on his dead back. Most people never make it into the history books. It's like what Thoreau said. What he said was true. The people who do manage to get into the history books, by and large, are the generals and the admirals and the field marshals, and this is August the 12th, and we got plenty to talk about there. And they get into the history book based upon the number of other human lives that they have reduced to abject misery or slain outright. And for that accomplishment, we call them great. You know, maybe there will be a dependent clause in a history book about Robin Williams. In the same sentence with a dependent clause about Groucho Marx or W.C. Fields or Red Fox or Lenny Bruce or George Carlin. These people made other human beings less miserable, not more. So it kind of pissed me off when I got up this morning, and we were less than 12 hours from me learning the news of what had happened to Robin Williams. And I see people I know referring to him as stupid, selfish, mentally ill. When the only thing I was inclined to think of him was that he was human and led a human life and came to a human end. Because, you know, if you're, you know what? If you're laying there in a hospital bed, and I've seen two human beings I loved most on this earth do this, laying in a hospital bed, gasping for the next breath, trying not to leave, because they didn't feel done yet, and yet having to go. Going by choice seems a hell of a lot more human. Than going as a piece of meat connected to technology. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, yeah, there's Shepard Smith over at Fox. Tell us about it, Shep.
Gives him a sense of wonder. And I want to quote from him again. My children give me a great sense of wonder just to see them develop into these extraordinary human beings. And a favorite book as a child growing up, it was The Lion. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I'd read the whole C.S. Lewis series outside to my kids. I was once reading to Zelda, and she said, don't do any voices. Just read it yourself. So I did. I just read it straight. And she said, that's better. One of the children he so loved. One of the children grieving tonight. Because their father killed himself in a fit of depression. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? You could love three little things so much, watch them grow, and they're in their mid-20s, and they're inspiring you and exciting you, and they fill you up with a kind of joy you could never have known, and yet something inside you is so horrible, or you're such a coward, or whatever the reason, that you decide you have to end it.
May I politely say, go to hell, Shepard Smith. Now, understand, he started a big kerfuffle, and the PR department at Fox went, yay, Shep started a kerfuffle, more free PR for us. And he apologized and said, I don't know why I said it. He said it, Shepard Smith, because you're a self-important asshole who has no idea whether he was depressed or not and has no business commenting on it anyway. But you're in the business of titillating people. I like to think, never mind. You think that's bad? Oh, dear. That's the humane guy. That's the Fox anchor that liberals and progressives kind of like. He's not as nasty as the attack blondes or Ducey or Kilmeade. Then there's this.
Now, what is the left's worldview in general? What is, if you had to attach... not a philosophy, but an attitude to a leftist worldview. It's one of pessimism and darkness, sadness. They're never happy, are they? They're always angry about something. No matter what they get, they're always angry. And they are animated in large part by the false promises of America. Because the promises of America are not for everyone, as we see each and every day. mean, right here, there's a story, Fox News website. Do you know? It says right here that the real reasons that Robin Williams killed himself, well, he was embarrassed at having to take television roles after a sterling movie career, that he had to take movie roles that were beneath him, sequels and so forth, and he finally had to do television just to get a paycheck because he was in so much financial distress. He'd had some divorces that ripped up his net worth, and he had a big ranch in Napa that he couldn't afford any longer and had to put up for sale, and a house in Tiburon he couldn't afford anymore. This is all what's in the Fox News story. He had it all, but he had nothing. Made everybody else laugh, but was miserable inside. I mean, it fits a certain picture or a certain image that the left has. I mean, they talk about low expectations and this general unhappiness and so forth. And right here it says that it was one of the contributing factors to Robin Williams deciding to kill himself was survivor's guilt. And I read this in the headline. Survivor's guilt? Whoa. What survivor's guilt? What? So I read it, and it turns out that three of his closest friends, the story says, three of his closest friends were Christopher Reeve.
Oh, stop. I can't stand anymore. This guy's a ghoul. This guy's a feaster on human flesh. Whether he's flying down to the Dominican Republic with a bottle of illicit Viagra on an all-boys weekend, or sending his maid out with a cigar box full of cash to bring him back a big box of OxyContin street drugs. Or telling a caller to call me back when you get the bone out of your nose. This guy's nothing but gutter trash. Now, I think it was Plato who said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." Rush Limbaugh disproves that theory, because he at least still thinks there's something about his sorry existence that is worth hanging on to. So does Dick Cheney and that decent human being's heart in his chest. And whoever wrote that business that he was quoting from, screw him too. This is not the be-all and end-all of world culture, and certainly not of enlightenment. And most of our attitudes toward suicide are basically, essentially, grounded in religion. You have to remember that the early church arose as a death martyr cult. In the days following the crucifixion of Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi, a great debate took place among the early followers. And the debate was whether to enshrine the teachings of his life or celebrate his gory, all too prosaic for that time and that place, murder at the hands of the state. The death cult won out, and that is Christianity down to us unto this day. But because the young religion was founded upon death and martyrdom, they had to be careful that the new adherents not run around offing themselves Remember, in the earliest books in the New Testament are written by Paul, not the gospel authors, whomever they were. And he's telling people, look, I had a vision of the risen Christ. The crucifixion is all that matters, and he's going to be back here any day now. And you had people refusing to have sex, refusing to procreate. You had people checking out of society, living in communes, providing vast potential for the destabilization of empire. And the early church fathers had to step in and say, no, 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 no. Just because he ain't here yet doesn't mean that you get to just starve yourself to death. But if somebody decides to kill you, well, we'll celebrate your death. But we're not going to celebrate, no, we're going to send you to hell if you do it yourself. So it is henceforth declared that there is something wrong with you if you decide to check out on your own terms. And I would submit that the essence of our feelings about it to this day arise out of that position, because the Roman Empire, in which that decision was declared, had a completely different understanding. Reference Seneca that Lottie mentioned in the chat room a little bit ago. It was not only understandable, it was deemed rational. Right? Yeah. So, you know, just a few observations. Turn away, and I don't give orders around here, but turn away. If people want to put up, oh, clearly you're suffering from mental illness and I've been in a facility, right? I'm in trouble with drugs. Just turn away from that shit. Reject that shit. Because that's what it is. It's cack. And I think it was Texas T in the chat room said, did you ever notice how the right-wingers want to declare who has to be born and declare who can't die or should die, and then we can all get effed in the middle? That's it in a nutshell. Maybe, and this is the only speculation I'll engage in, maybe Robin Williams had a little bit more brain power than that goddamned oxymoron Flush Flemball. Maybe he made an intelligent and rational examination of his life. God knows Rush Limbaugh never has. Did the check clear? Huh. How about that? Good, 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 good. Tell my wife down in the pit the check cleared, so she'll be there another month. See how it works? Yeah. And hey, $7 to go. $7 to go to meet Paul from Parts Unknown's birthday challenge for this evening. $7. And then we'll have only $100 more to go to meet last night and tonight's fundraising goal. So that's awesome. Yeah, what the hell is a leftist worldview anyway, Flush Flimball, you bowl floater, you. Oh, there he goes, calling names. That's called an analogy. I'm analogizing Rush Limbaugh to something that floats in a toilet bowl. Let's be clear. But yeah, that leftist worldview where we actually look at the troubles in the world today, and it becomes overwhelming. Whereas good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-thumping Republicans, they just are happy, happy, happy all the time because money! Except they're not so happy all the time because, well, they want it all, and they don't have it all yet. Thank you to Glenn and to Frank for putting us for finishing off, and to the good, we are $3 past the fundraising goal. To wit, Paul from Parts Unknown's Tuesday challenge. So all those contributions will be doubled by Paul. Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Frank, and thank you, Glenn, and thank you, Sal, and thank you, Marty. Thank you very kindly. It is 25 minutes past the hour. We are roughly at the halfway point of the evening's program, this Titanic Tuesday. I mean, if Shepard Smith and the oxymoron don't count as great exemplars of Titanic intellect, I don't know what does. But let us go now to the Skype line, where waiting for us is our buddy the Angry Indian. Hey, Angry.
Hey, how you doing, man?
Pretty good, you?
No, I'm not that good.
I know. That's just banter, but yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, you were talking about Mike Brown earlier, which is, you know, kind of tough, you know, coming after talking about Thoreau and so on. But, you know, in terms of suffering, you know, I really don't know how much more the African community in the United States is supposed to take. And, I mean, to paraphrase James Baldwin, and I've said this to you, you know, in my own way, fought in every conflict this country's ever had. You know, 400 years of slavery, right? What have you? You know, all of the lynching, you know, all of the things that we all know went down and go down. And here it is, this kid is supposed to start college this week. His parents now have to plan his funeral. And, you know, every white person that I know pretty much around me, other than a couple of people who were active in the 60s, you know, in terms of, you know, being counterculture, everybody else is telling me that, you know, the black community needs to calm down.
I haven't said it, Angry. Now, hold on.
No. You know what I'm talking about. You know, look, when you throw a rock into a crowd of dogs, the only one that hollers is the one that gets hit. You know that's not an issue. Mike Malloy, it is an issue, right, for two people that most of your listeners will know. Brad Friedman, don't have to argue this with him. But the idea that African folks are so angry that they're yelling at the police. And, you know, there was a rumor that there was yells to kill the police. It turns out that was a lie. I believe it was MSNBC was spreading that, for a while. No evidence of it. You know, and it became a meme. It was all over the place. No. African people stood up and said, look, we're tired of you killing us. And the fact that his grandmother, because remember, this was not his community. You know, he was visiting.
Yeah, so you know who else was visiting, Angry? Hmm. And when I read that he was on a visit, my mind immediately turned. Emmett Till was visiting, too.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but see, most young folks, they won't even connect that to this. But you're of an age group, yeah, you know, you remember this, and this is the same sort of case. The only difference was Emmett Till at least was accused of something. Right? Supposedly, he made a pass, he winked at a white woman. You know, which supposedly he would do back home, but he couldn't do here, and he didn't understand that because he was past the Mason-Dixon line. In this case, this young man and his friend were told to get back up on the sidewalk. And from that order from the police officer, which, according to the friend, they did what they were told. Nobody really seems to understand. Now, the story isn't clear. You know, we're hearing from the police that he was in the vehicle. Then we're hearing that he was running. You know, it's ridiculous. But what we do understand is there was no weapon. There was no excuse.
Yeah, I'm not disputing anything with you, Angry. I want to expand on something you just mentioned.
Hmm.
You know about the eyeball, the unwritten eyeball rule.
Yeah. It still exists. It depends on where you are, of course, but it still exists.
And hand in glove with the eyeball rule was the step-off rule in the Old South.
Well, and, not just the Old South.
Well, okay, the old United States.
I experienced it in the 70s, you know what I mean? That's the last time I had to deal with that type of thing.
But it, you know, it said that if white people were coming down the sidewalk, a person of color had to step off into the mud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, this is the. Isn't there a strange sort of synchronicity between that and this? Get back up on the sidewalk.
Look,
you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I remember waiting, and this wasn't even in the 70s. This was a date that I was on in the early 90s. I was meeting a woman, and she was white, actually. And, you know, here we are in, you know, a major metropolitan city, waiting for the light to change. I know not to jaywalk. You dig what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I know not to jaywalk. And I'm waiting for her. She's waving to me. I wave back. Sirens. You know.
Huh?
What are you doing here? Why are you standing here? Then when she came over and said, look, he's with me, how do you know him? You know, I mean, it ruined our entire evening. Now, I mean, you know, it didn't go any further than that, than just being harassed. But, you know, still, these things happen on a daily basis. You never understand, you never really know for sure when you're dealing with a police officer what their day was like, whether or not they had a bad night, whether or not he's angry that he lost $100 or more in poker, you know, the afternoon before. You don't know what you're dealing with. And they will take out their frustrations on people. I've seen it happen. You've seen it happen. But when it comes to this particular issue, you know, we have to be really honest with ourselves and stop beating around the mulberry bush and start admitting that the majority of police officers now, they may not necessarily go into the system with this attitude, or at least they hadn't at one point. But since Nixon, there's been an increasing militarization of the police that was done under Nixon primarily to deal with the Black Panther Party and the more extreme offshoot that came off from that, the Black Liberation Army, otherwise known as BLOC.
Well, that and the beginnings in 1974 by Nelson Rockefeller in New York, that's where the war on drugs starts.
Yeah, well, they used the entire war on drugs to, you know, equip the early SWAT teams. That was the whole idea behind that, the war on drugs, and we needed to have this firepower to deal with the firepower of the drug gangs. But then, you know, you turn around, you find out under COINTELPRO, when a lot of that came out during the church committee hearings, which a lot of, you know, I mean, everybody needs to look that up if you want to understand everything that's going on right now, and I mean everything. They decided to use the Black Panther Party for self-defense, not exclusively, but primarily, as a target of COINTELPRO, and they use local police departments to handle basically the gendarme actions of this while they plan the activities. The assassination of Fred Hampton in Chicago was proven in court, you know, to have been, you know, a clear-cut state-run assassination program by an informant working for the government who gave them the layout of the place. And nothing was done, you know, that when the church committee hearing found out, you know, what was going on, and to the socialist groups, a handful of white supremacist groups, even though they tended to use them. You can look up William Sullivan, the cat that was connected to the JFK assassination. He was in charge of what was understood, or at least came out later on in trials of Geronimo Pratt and the Reuben Ben Rahab, and what was known as the Black Desk, where they specifically targeted not just, you know, people that they considered to be black extremists, which we can argue about this, about the Black Panther Party, but Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King, I mean, his entire family was targeted under this program. And a lot of people do not remember that his mother was assassinated in church and that his brother, A.D. King, was found in a suit floating in the family pool. It was ruled a homicide. You dig?
Yeah.
So, you know, so there's a history of this, and the fact that, you know, Barack Obama is president now, and this has bothered a lot of people, you know, I mean, like your caller earlier in the show said, a lot of Democrats, a lot of people that I know that swear up and down that they're liberals, they are, you know, no less Republican when it comes into believing that there's some secret Muslim agenda. There's a secret Black Power agenda. You know, that there's this plot to destabilize white America and that Obama is the head of this. I'm hearing this from Democrats as well as Republicans. And libertarians are just completely off the scale. You know, they're totally out in the stratosphere with their ideas. But, you know, what we're seeing here is, you know, the police realizing that they can pretty much do what the hell they want to do. And there's a culture that has developed within the police departments around the country. I mean, we've had various black representatives from separate, and it's a damn shame that black police officers even feel that they need to have separate unions. You know, we're not even discussing that. But when they talk about their colleagues, they're like, look, the racism here is so thick you can cut it with a knife. And, you know, there's no let up on it. And then you turn around and find out that with the anti-terrorism training that they're receiving, that it turns out it's not just from the federal government, but also from the state of Israel. I can send you the links. You know, I knew that they were involved to an extent, but I didn't know this much. But, you know, of course, many Africans in the United States practice Islam.
Sure.
And so, you know, so a lot of this, you know, prejudice, I mean, you have officers who maybe didn't even think one way or other about black people. But if they're associating the Islamic threat with black males, you know, that then this is just one more thing that we have to confront. And this is just one more thing that we have to worry about. Remember what Stanley Kuhn said on the stand in the Rodney King trial? He was black. He was larger than me. He was muscular. And I was afraid. And there were white people on that jury that cried, all right? And they were acquitted that first round. If it wasn't for the riot, you wouldn't have had a second trial. And I do want to say this, too, while I have an opportunity, because this needs to be discussed. The riot that happened after this was a goddamn shame.
You're talking about the Mike Brown matter.
In the Mike Brown thing, yeah, because I'm connecting this to what happened with Rodney King. See, now, the thing that went down with Rodney King is when you actually look at the stats, the majority of the people who were filmed and eventually arrested for the looting in L.A. were mostly Spanish-speaking people from South America and Mexico. Now, the majority of Africans, I'm not saying that black people were not involved in the looting. Certainly they were. I mean, there are criminal gangs in every ethnic group, and they took advantage of the chaos. The same as what we're talking about with Missouri.
Yeah, but let me ask you a question real quick, Angry.
Yeah.
Is it not true that people in Ferguson, Missouri, who are protesting in their own front yards are being gassed in their own front yards?
Yeah, I sent you a link that I saw from Chris Hayes that that's been going on, and there's other reports as well. I mean, because of, you know, social media, and we have to really give credit to those people who are dedicated and they're using their digital devices to try to report what's going on, you know, right there. We're seeing tanks. Dogs were released on people yesterday. There was a no-fly zone that was mandated by the FAA earlier this morning, I believe. So, you know, they're really going over the top with this. And so, yeah, what you're saying is true. People are on their own property. I'm talking about homeowners now, not renters. We're talking about homeowners are being threatened and being gassed, you know, on their own property because they're witnessing that this military operation is going on their front lawn. You know, I mean, you know, they left this young man's body out in the street for several hours. The blood was trailing down the asphalt. They refused to move the body. No respect for the man's remains. And like I said, his family was there. No respect at all. And in the meantime, one of the local politicians, he had a rifle pointed in his face.
Yep.
I believe he's an alderman. He had a rifle pointed in his face. But, you know, let's worry about the odds these that no one really knew anything about before a week, until last week, who the hell ever knew who these people were? And since when did the right wing ever give a damn? And see, this is what I was saying about Minister Maurice Muhammad, the cat that I told you is marching with Open Carry Texas. They're doing this on the 16th through a black community, the Fifth Ward in I believe it's Houston. And, you know, he is fronting for a group of white supremacists, basically, who want the right to carry a AR-15, a field-grade weapon, into a shopping mall. Okay, so we have this young man being shot, and I'm seeing all kinds of wild calls from not just Muhammad, but from a lot of people saying that black people need to arm up. Well, this is exactly what the white supremacists want.
They want a race war. They have been fantasizing and masturbating over a race war for eons now.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, and you know, I talked about this in the piece that you know I published last week about Afrocentrism in terms of its revisionist side. You know, you have a lot of Africans that want a race war too. And see, and one of my concerns is, and this is connected to the riot. There are people who are justifying the looting of these businesses, saying that it was justified because this young black man got shot. They're connecting things that have no connection. And this is, you know, us not paying attention to what happened during L.A. Those riots didn't do a goddamn thing. I'm talking about in terms of the looting. It did absolutely nothing. And we also should have learned a lesson. Do you remember his name, Bob, the fellow that was pulled out of his truck?
No.
The white truck driver doing the L.A. riots. He was pulled out of his truck and nearly beaten to death. I mean, he still lives with brain damage. I can't remember his name. But this man was just doing his job, and he was driving through...
We would probably do well to remember his name. He deserves it.
He deserves it. Reginald Denny, I believe his name. And if it's wrong, somebody please correct me. He was beaten within an inch of his life. Because of the pure frustration of these people, and he was the only white person in the area, and they grabbed him. Now, they reported this on and on and on about how animalistic the black crowd was, the way they did in Missouri. They, you know, one officer is actually on film, a news service, a local news agency got it, calling the protesters animals. So what I'm saying is, you know, people got to chill out. I guess I'm using a lot of words to say something simple. People need to really chill and think about what the hell is happening. In terms of the protesters down there in Missouri, I think they need to shout and yell and take over the streets. I really do. But I don't think they need to be looting businesses. I don't think they need to be destroying property.
No, because look, looting is a criminal act. It is also an act of collective punishment, which is, at least for most of the world, deemed improper and illegal. It's a matter of punishing something for something someone didn't do. I always hate to hear when that sort of thing goes on, because you know what? It's also misdirected anger. Don't loot a convenience store. Get 25,000 people surrounding the police department and do not leave until you have had satisfaction.
Yeah, but see, it's not even real politically looting. It's not like the Molly Maguire's breaking into the company store and handing out the coats and the blankets and the bread and the cornmeal.
No.
And see, that's why, you know, for the most part, you know, like you said, yes, it's illegal. But, you know, I can't support that. And what I'm saying is that we really need to be careful about the language that we're using, because, you know, folks will take, you know, on either end of the extreme. We use this as an excuse to do whatever the hell they want to do, you know, because they had their own agendas. Open Carry Texas, they're probably looking at this as a godsend right now. The NRA certainly is. Because if you got a police officer that can be caught on film calling black people animals, well, that's just a justification. What do you do with wild animals?
Shoot them.
You know, and the black folks that are out here, you know, talking wild, they're not thinking about this. You know, because, like I said, after the riots in L.A., even though, you know, African people were not the majority of the folks, you know, ethnically who were doing a lot of that, the press did not give a damn about that. It was just, you know, one more thing that they were able to use to justify another police crackdown on the black community. You know, and like I said, you know, I write about this often and I talk about it on my own radio show. you got a lot of people, just like in the white community. You know, I mean, in one sense, you know, here they'll have a handlebar mustache, a beer gut, a big Confederate flag, and a shotgun. But then on the other hand, you know, you got a lot of black cats, man, that wish they had that armory, but they don't have the means to get it, really. But they wear the camouflage, they talk tough, they stand around, and they, you know, and they threaten. Both ends, when you really talk to them, if you can get them to sit down with a cup of coffee and to, you know, drop their ideology for a minute, they're broke, they're kept out of the system, you know, that they have no means to do anything, and they really believe that the entire world is against them. So then, you know, they'll accept any theory, any kind of crazy idea that says that, yeah, well, you know, this will be the ground, you know, the ground floor to getting what we want to do. You know, and I'm so glad that you said race war, because nobody in the press wants to talk about this. You know, even though you can look around and it doesn't take very long to find out that you have people who are not necessarily Republican operatives, even though some of them are, but who are definitely connected to the Republican Party that are right here, you know, talking this kind of language. And no one's saying anything about this. And to say that there's not police officers that are running around with this attitude is simply ridiculous. You know, it's not being realistic. And while we're talking about this, it turns out another man was killed just last night, Azel Ford in L.A., 24 years old.
And who was the guy who was blown away in Walmart for carrying a BB gun?
Yeah, I don't know the details about that. You probably know more about that than I do.
He picked up a BB gun. And the cops came and wasted him. Now, of course, he was of dark skin hue. And the first thing that comes to mind is, wait a minute, there's all kinds of gunned up white folks walking around these big box stores now, you know, carrying their Oreos, ha ha, see, Oreo, you know, like Obama, black on the outside, white on the inside, ha ha, got my gun. And oddly enough, no cops have come in and wasted them. But a black guy carries a BB gun out of the toy department and gets blown away?
The background narrative is the white guy is supposed to have that gun.
Yeah.
That makes sense. He's supposed to have that gun, you know. He's supposed to have that. You know, look, you and I have said this. We've heard Mike Beloy say. We've heard a lot of, you know, people, you know, talk about this. We're dealing with the American Taliban. But no one really wants to admit this, all right? We have this core within the United States and Canada, and then you have these opportunistic police officers who feel that every time, you know, they stomp on a black person, they're doing work for God. If you listen to some of them talk, go to police blogs and look at the language that they use. You know, I mean, they have no respect for the people in which they serve. And it turns out that even though this is a primarily African community in Missouri, the majority of the police force is white. And do not live in the community, have no connection to Ferguson, other than to come in and do their work. So, you know, this is going to happen again until, you know, the Obama administration does something about it. Which I don't expect them to do anything about it, because we have a genocide going on in the Gaza, while they're talking about a genocide in Iraq, and, you know, it both funded by the same, you know, by the same people when you really sit and look at it. I mean, we're talking all the time about torture and, you know, whether or not you can apply human rights to a kill list. And then we're wondering why it's so easy for the authorities to just shoot a black person in the United States and, you know, we're upset for about a week, or a Mexican or a Native American, because nobody discusses those cases. You know, we can have this. I mean, if you have genocide going on that you're involved in overseas, why wouldn't it operate within your own country, right under your nose? I mean, you really have to be a fool or a... you know, really a white supremacist, you know, in your heart to not want to be able to see that. But it's right in front of us.
Yeah. I mean, You kind of rendered me speechless. I mean, that encapsulates so very much. And I'm all wrapped up in the difference between 1914 and 2014 angry. And I'm not seeing a hell of a lot of difference. There's plenty to be terrified of. Texas Betsy just sent a message saying, please be clear on who is committing genocide and who is not. I'll leave that up to you. We're not calling it ISIS or ISIL, and we're just calling it IS, you know, with the Yazidis.
The Islamic State.
Yeah, the Islamic State. And you know, frankly, I think that's a mistake because they are non-state actors.
Well, that's the whole thing. They're using the new 21st century idea of state because WikiLeaks, for example, is a stateless news agency, right? Then you have, you know, ethnic groups that claim, you know, nationhood, statehood, when they don't actually own any land. I mean, I'm Gullah. We consider ourselves to be a nation. We have someone, we have a queen that we consider to be our head of state, but we have no borders. You know, we have no actual territory. You know, I mean, we believe that we are. So, you know, it's the same sort of thing. They've already started handing out passports, I believe. You know, if the European reports are true, you know, they're making up passports. And they're pretending that they're a state. So, you know, it's, you know, how language is being used by the press and then, you know, the perspective that these people are using. And then here's the other thing, and I've written about this recently, too. You see Hamas has become politicized. The Muslim Brotherhood has become politicized. Well, it didn't take too long for the Nazis in Europe to figure out that this could work. The National Front have been trying for years, but then they've gotten legitimacy recently. You have the National Front in the UK. They've lost some seats recently, but you have UKIP that's fronting like that. You have the British movement.
Well, the modern Nazi Party in Germany, which is not referred to as the Nazi Party because it's illegal, it receives state funding now because they achieved the threshold number of votes in parliamentary elections.
Yeah, so, you know, the neo-Nazis in the United States are realizing that the same thing can work if they just continue to keep plugging at it. And I've always believed that Fox News was part of that because, you know, rumor has it on the anti-fascist network that Rupert Murdoch has always been connected to the neo-Nazi movement in Australia. He's just been very hands-off about it. Matter of fact, Mel Gibson, the actor, his father, who, even though he's American-born,
Hutton Gibson. You know, I know about Hutton, yes.
You know about Hutton, right? So, you know, he's also been connected to the fascist movement in Australia. And they did the same sort of thing that, you know, that I've talked about with you before, that they will say that they support Aboriginal rights in Australia, but at the same time they have a pro-white, whites-only agenda. You know, using one thing to say that they're not racist as a screen to get a certain level of respectability. And supposedly that is what happened with Murdoch. And why, you know, even though in Australia people look at him as a fascist, that the view isn't like that outside. You know, I mean, all of them are starting to, like, play. Okay, remember when Glenn Beck was jumping up and down about Saul Alinsky?
Oh, when doesn't he?
Yeah, well, what did I just tell you yesterday? I sent you a link. You know, the German neo-Nazis are now saying that they support the state of Israel and that they're not anti-Semitic.
Oh, the Klan, the Klan says that, too.
Yeah, you know, that they've been misunderstood, you know. And then when you point out the language they use in their literature, they're like, well, we don't deny that. Well, it's just free speech, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean look, if your goal, I mean, you can say, hey, you know, every ethnicity needs its own homeland. And, of course, they you know, the idiots in the Klan and the Nazis, they think white is an ethnicity.
Yeah, but they're insane. I mean, you know, this idea of a racially pure Europe, you know, it was just, you know, all
that whole concept is just stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm not jumping at you, Angry, that's just dumb. Because Europe, so-called white Europe, is an admixture of every tribal society that existed there, plus incursions from the steppes in Central Asia over the last 3,000 years.
Well, come on, China almost invaded. If it wasn't for a political problem at home, they were going to take over Europe.
I mean, there's,
and they could have.
There are, and I don't want to be, I don't want to be taken as some sort of eugenicist or as it's called, social Darwinism, and I hate that phrase anyway, because it's not Darwinian at all.
No, it's not.
But you know, people have moved all over Europe for. As long, ever since the ice sheets receded, there are what were called Moorish genes, and they're to be found to this day in Spain.
Yeah, but don't tell them that. They keep bringing up the Goths. Yeah.
Well, not so much the Goths, but the Vandals. Remember?
Which is crazy.
I mean, we get the word vandalism from the behavior of the Vandals.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
the Vandals cruised down the Iberian Peninsula and then crossed at Gibraltar and went across North Africa. You know, there are still Crusader genes in the peoples of the Levant. And that would be French, primarily French and German and some Italian genes.
Well, if you look at Palestinian people, for example, Syrians, right, you'll see blue eyes.
Consider the iconic photograph of the woman, the young girl at the time, in Afghanistan with those striking blue eyes.
Consider that the
city Kandahar, that's not a Pashtun or Afghan word. That's one of the cities that Alexander established and left a beachhead contingent there. The writings of the classical Romans describe complexions and physical characteristics that are largely at odds with folks you see on the streets of Rome now. Pompey Magnus was described as having a Gaulish look. And to be Gaulish was to be fair of hair and green or blue or occasionally brown of eye. And we haven't even gotten to the Germans yet. And this is before any pressure, any populational pressure, is put on Europe from the East. I mean, the idea of white Europe is kind of stupid.
Yeah, but you're talking about authentic, verifiable, documented, traceable historical fact. But that doesn't work in the mind of a fascist.
Well, that's where I live, Angry. I'm sorry. That, you know, verifiable fact business. I mean, it just is. I mean, here, let me. You want to go for a ride with me real quick, Angry? You might enjoy this.
Sure.
For some reason or another, and this has to do with my classical fixation, July and August always occasion a lot of thought in me, because up until like 43 BCE, July was just called, let's see, Quintilis. It was just the fifth month. But upon the murder of Gaius Julius Caesar, it is named after the divine Julius. And since his adopted grandnephew follows in his footsteps and is eventually, you know, Gaius Octavianus, and is eventually nicknamed, cognomened Augustus, well, he was born in the eighth month, or the sixth month, which was Sextilis, and which we now call August after him. And August is, well, I published a poem on Facebook earlier in which I noted that T.S. Eliot said April is the cruelest month, but my assertion is that August is no damn slouch either. And with that in mind, a few things to consider. In 30 BCE, on the 12th day of August, Cleopatra the 7th Philopator, that Cleopatra, does her snake dance, rather than be led in chains through the streets of Rome by Gaius Octavianus. How you like them apples? Then, 1,129 years later, and this is the one that really smacked me in the face, in what is considered to be the final engagement of the First Crusade, crusaders under the command of Godfrey de Bouillon defeated native forces led by Al-Afdal Shanshah at a little place called Ascalon. Now, why did this grab me? Because nothing changes. The area that had been conquered by the Crusaders was referred to in French as Outre-mer. It means overseas. And it took in the Kingdom of Jerusalem and a couple of others. And they held on to it for a couple of years, or a couple of centuries. Ashkelon is in Gaza.
Okay, I heard of Ascalon, but I wasn't making the connection because it has a few different names, several different names historically. But, well, yeah, but, you know, again, you know, Bob, you're talking about history, and people don't like to deal with that. I'm still trying to get Republicans that are hardcore Christians to explain to me why the Crusades made any sense anyway. Because, you know, I say that they were in expansionist invasions because in 1492 they started wiping out Jews. Because remember, we were talking about Spain earlier, right? That's where the, you know, I mean, they want to say that everything started with Muslims in Islamic countries. That, you know, there was tension, but it wasn't like this. After the Reconquista, you know, Catholic Spain decided to expel not just all Muslims, but all Jews.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and Columbus, to a lot of Native Americans, you know, who are concerned about these issues, 1492 was also the same year that we were invaded.
Mm-hmm.
And the Catholic Church said, yeah, you know, if you can't enslave them, then get rid of them. So, you know, to me, the Crusades has always just been part of that. But then you hear from, you know, hardcore conservatives that will say, oh, well, you know, they were going to save, right, the Holy Land. They were going to save. They were going to liberate it. And then it comes back to the question, well, how did Europeans receive the religion in the first place? As you say, you know, the belief system based around a dark-skinned Palestinian day labor. How did they make the connection that Christianity belongs to them? That they have a right to invade, to preemptively invade, right? Three different crusades to retake something that didn't belong to them in the first place. And mowing away people in the meantime. Reducing them, you know, philosophically, theologically, to absolutely nothing. Justifying all of the torture, all of the disembowelment, all of the sexual abuse of their women, you know, the destruction of their temples, you know, their belief system, their cultures, everything. And then copying what they developed as their own. I mean, when you hear about Israeli couscous, what are we really talking about? You know, when we hear about Israeli falafel, what are we really talking about here?
No, we're talking
Israeli hummus.
Well, I mean, falafel's falafel and hummus is hummus.
Well, yeah, but it's from where? You know,
well,
so
I mean,
these
are traditional dishes that have been eaten for, you know, since agriculture or probably earlier.
Yeah, but what I'm getting to is that you will hear people, because I hear this, you know, my little quarter bit of Ashkenazim blood, I get invited sometimes. The things, and you know, people will sit and argue with me that they were actually eating this diet in Krakow, that they were eating this diet in Russia, and I have to point out to them that there is no such thing as a Jewish cuisine, that you know, things were picked up everywhere we were, you know,
Levantine cuisine.
Yeah, well, even then, there's arguments about that too, in terms of how people got over, but it's just the idea that if you can have this group that can justify what the hell is going on in Gaza right now, funded by U.S. taxpayer money, right? doing what they're doing, looking at the little bits of things that I'm talking about in terms of, you know, cultural co-opting and, you know, theological justifications for things, this is not disconnected to what happened to Mike Brown. Because how many, you say this yourself on this show regularly, how many white people really walk around the United States in the 21st century and say to themselves, God gave us this, you know, this country? And, you know, if a bunch of Indians had to be wiped out, too bad. If we had to enslave some, you know, some African people, ship them in, too bad.
Progress.
These things, that's progress. You know, these things happen.
The march of civilization.
You know, how many people do you, I mean, really, are out here watching what's happening in Missouri and thinking that this will finally, you know, start what, again, the race war, right? That this will start what we need to start.
Oh, there's, yeah, there's people yearning. Do you doubt me? There's people yearning.
Absolutely not. This is what I'm concerned about. Because the crackdown is going to come down. It's not going to come down on the white supremacists. It's going to come down
on
the
African. No, and it's not going to come down on the people calling for a race war. It's going to come down on the people who are trying to live their lives and can't seem to walk from point A to point B without being summarily executed by the police.
I mean, look at it this way. You and I have talked about this before, too. When that Marine sniper team in Afghanistan was filmed with that photograph that was leaked with the SS flag.
Oopsie.
You know, I mean, if that didn't explain where we were and the fact that there's neo-Nazi graffiti in Afghanistan and Iraq, who's leaving this? And then you have the Klan on film, Barcroft TV. I believe that they're British. You can go to YouTube and find this, and I've linked to it several times, where they're saying that, hey, we're going to start a race war. And we're going to, you know, we're going to take over the government, and we're going to do what we need to do to preserve our white race. Why are these people not being investigated under RICO?
See, this is one of those places where, at the risk of beginning to sound like Alex Jones, who is to say?
Watch it, Dana.
I know. But, well, no, I have to be really careful. It hurts my throat to do that. But how do we know? And I'm going to extrapolate a little bit and probably a little too broadly. But you remember when the... Okay, so first of all, Bill Clinton leaves office and this myth is created that the mean liberals have pried all the W's off all the keyboards in the White House as if the government didn't have enough money to buy new keyboards. Remember that?
But yeah, then, I remember Freedom Fries too. Yes.
Yeah, but then the Bush administration leaves office, and what we find out in the wake of that is that the entire federal government has had little sleeper cells of loyal Bushies implanted in it. Now
yes,
I read stories of cops shooting black guys carrying a BB gun from the toy department to go and purchase it, or go and say to the spouse partner, hey, do you think Junior's old enough to have a BB gun yet? And gets blown away. Or a guy doesn't step onto the sidewalk fast enough and he gets killed instead of getting to go to college. Or a black woman on her back being repeatedly beaten in the head by a member of the California Highway Patrol.
Yeah.
And I admit, okay, this is speculation, and, you know, maybe it's time for me to use the Thorazine Dart self-administration kit. But I keep wondering if these neo-Nazis, these neo-fascists, these oath keepers, these birthers, baggers, deathers, tenthers, booger eaters, libertarians, John Birchers, don't have more than their fair share of little sleeper cells inside things like police forces and National Guard units.
Of course. I mean, I've spoken to fellows, you know, doing interviews who have, you know, done time. They say, yeah, man, the corrections officers are Klan members. They wear their rings at work. They wear their rings at work. And if we want to talk about the O.J. Simpson case, and just, you know, ahead of time, I don't give a damn about O.J. Simpson. I never really did. But, you know, the court case was the court case. But what came out in the court case? not only that the LAPD makes a habit of beating the hell out of their out of the public when they come into contact with them, and not only did they catch that one cat lying on the stand, it turned out that he and Van Adder belonged to a white supremacist group within the LAPD. At least this is what came out during the trial, but it didn't have any effect, supposedly, on the trial, right?
Right.
I mean, Furman, you know, was a known bigot. He admitted this. This was on tape. You know, and you know, we're going to pretend that there's no connection, you know, to what happened with Simpson, you know, in a lot of cases in terms of how they went about the investigation. You know, high-profile case like the Rodney King riots or Sean Bell. A lot of people forget about that. Shot the day before he was getting married 50 times.
Yeah.
They came up with a new term from that one. I remember that one. I guess it's peculiar to the New York Police Department. Contagious shooting. That they just can't stop. That once they you know, they start emptying out, they get into a flow.
Yeah, but there aren't any. I mean, even the cops who carry Glocks, there are no 52 round Glocks. What happens is it's contagious from cop to cop. One starts shooting and the other one follows, mm-hmm. and another one after
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And see, the thing is, I've spoken to police officers in my family, who, when I've asked them, I'm like, you know, what the hell is you know this contagious shooting thing? And he said, you know, I mean, most of them, you know, one in particular, he said, look, you know, it is like that. When one of us fires, the other one. Boom, that's the way we're trained. That's how to react. But almost all of them said the main thing is fear. Because, you know, you know bullets start flying, you hear shots, you know that you're carrying, boom. You're not going to, you know, right? You react. That's their training. That's their training. Okay, fine. But then if that's their training and we're spending millions, if not billions of dollars on this training, why is it that in a civilian environment they don't know how to act? They don't know how to conduct themselves properly. And then when they're found to be wrong or found to have had a mistake, right, if we want to, you know, use that term, they're not held to account. Maybe they lose their job, but they all end up on disability because of the stress they went through, right?
Well, I'd like to point something out here real quick, Angry. And it goes back to a story from several years ago now. And it had to do with a court case filed by a guy who really, really, really wanted to be a cop. I think it came out of New York, if I recall correctly. Somebody can look it up. So the guy takes the be a cop test. And part of that is an IQ inventory.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out he has an IQ higher than 120. At which point, his IQ was used as a basis to not let him be a cop. He was refused.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Michael Moore talked about that, yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, in the copping profession, you don't want people with that kind of IQ. Or at least the copping profession says it doesn't want them.
Well, yeah, see.
Because they might run around thinking.
You know, because as somebody, and I consider myself to be, you know, somewhat of an investigator, I noticed that when I study European cases, it's a much different, it seems to be anyway, a much different environment on how their officers conduct themselves and who they choose. Now, France has the same sort of thug problem that we have in the United States, and so does the UK. But there is something to be said about the fact that you would think that if you were trying to hire the very finest, you would want the most educated people that you could possibly find and the most psychologically stable people you could possibly find, of course. And IQs, well, I don't know how far we should go and maybe in terms of saying that this should be an IQ limit. But if you have 120, why the hell would you not want to hire this individual?
Because he can't be trusted. He cannot
be trusted.
He cannot be. She. Okay, let's quit with the sexism already. She cannot be trusted. She is possibly going to not follow orders at some point in time. Maybe she won't catch the spontaneous firing disease when everybody else is shooting. Remember, there's a certain protection. In following group conduct, because it is a hell of a lot easier to defend six cops who shoot one person than it is one cop or two cops who shoot one person.
Well, I'm going to say this, too, because you did mention female. I can't prove this, but I do remember speaking, again, to one of my relatives, who is female, retired police officer, and she did say to me that in her area, when she was working, that they had, during the, I guess, mid-90s, there was a period where there was assaults going up for some reason. I guess they had a lot of gang activity, and there was a lot of tension because, you know, police officers were, you know, reasonably afraid of armed gangs. And it turns out that when they, you know, you had cases where people were going, you know, officers were going beyond their charter, that female officers were actually, if they didn't try to intervene at the time, that they did, that they made reports. Now, like I said, I can't prove this, and I've heard this from other people as well, but there, if you go to YouTube, you will find a handful of cases of police officers that are filmed intervening. Not necessarily because they're being filmed, but because they're really trying to stop the overly aggressive officer. And I have to say this, and I'm saying this also to activists in the black community. We do not really offer those police officers that do, you know, come out, that do the Serpico move. We really don't support them because we can't expect the mainstream media to support them. And if you're old enough to remember the Serpico case, you know, you can't expect the police to protect these individuals from their own coworkers. I mean, the Serpico case, Bob, should be college material.
Required reading? Yeah.
Required reading, like Fred Hampton's assassination, but it isn't. Or the case of Geronimo Pratt, who was framed by COINTELPRO. Or the case of Daruba Ben Rahad, who was framed by COINTELPRO. The assassination of Malcolm X, the assassination of MLK. There are so many things we have never dealt with. And then we have the Obama administration, and if you go online now, I realize that the White House has made an official statement about the killing of Michael Brown, only because I'm going to assume of the social media pressure about this, because, you know, a lot of us have been asking him why he hasn't said anything. And especially with everything that's going on in the Gaza and the Yazidis, you know, a lot of black people are like, well, wait a goddamn minute, you know, what about us? So they made a statement, but we all know that that's about as far as it's going to go. You know, he's made his statement, and that's it. Now, he's had how much longer does he have to go?
January 20th,
2017. Yeah, so, I mean, he's going to do what between now and then to deal with these problems?
Okay, that
yeah.
No, see, this gets a little thorny. If you want to do something, there's not an executive order he can sign that will take care of a problem with the police department in Ferguson, Missouri.
No. Well, that's the whole thing. See, there are people who are really limiting it to that. But there needs to be, if we're going to go through the law route, you know, there needs to be a broad, nationwide, no matter where the hell you are, if you do this. Right, you know, there's going
well,
to be some
see,
sort
that's,
of some investigation.
That's what the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice is for.
Yeah,
and
but
could I please remind us all real quick that my senator Joe Manchin killed the nomination of a man, a perfectly eminently qualified man, as head of the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. Because he had written an appellate brief on behalf of Mumia. My senator helped kill that nomination.
Yeah, but how was he able to do that? All he had to mention was this cat had killed a cop.
Bingo.
See? And that's...
This black guy killed a cop.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is...
And this black guy wrote a brief supporting the black guy who killed the cop. Now, never mind the fact that the brief that the lawyer wrote was a brief that any lawyer worth her salt or his salt would write, because it turns out the court sided with the argument made in the brief.
But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Police officer, what is going on with Asada Shakur right now? Nobody's even thought about her. You dig what I'm saying? She's not released any papers. She's not made any statements. The last statement she did was an appeal to the Pope, the last Pope, right? Or actually, was it the Pope before the Nazi Pope? I'm not exactly sure, but she had appealed to the Vatican you know, I believe it was about her case, and had mentioned Mamiya. You dig what I'm saying? And what is the deal with her? The same thing. Even though, you know, the court case, the way that they laid it out, she was convicted. It couldn't possibly have gone down the way that they claimed that it went down. And now she is the first woman on the terrorist environmental list, one of these goddamn lists they have, you know, one of them, right?
Yeah.
You know, almost every black revolutionary that has been vilified by the system has in some way or another been accused of shooting police officers, right? And even though we really don't have a history of that. Now, on the other hand, and I've written about this, and you know this, how many white supremacists in this country have shot and killed police officers?
I can't give you the number.
How many off the top of my head. I don't even know where to begin. You know, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, how about that idiot that was trying to go over to the Tides Foundation after listening to Glenn Beck?
Well, there's him, or how about the guy in West Memphis, Arkansas, who was on his way to kill Obama?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Or how about the guy who answered his door in Pittsburgh, guns a-blazing when the cops knocked?
I mean, there's way more of them than there are of people of color walking around like that, even though if you want to look for that type of weaponry, if you want to see that type of stuff, all you got to do, because the English news seems to find them, the German press and the Finnish press seem to find these gangsters in Florida, in California, in Texas, in Louisiana, they have all of the stuff you see in Afghanistan. So, you know, why is it that they're allowed to be armed? See, this is what I'm talking about. They keep their communities, if you can excuse my French, fucked up. They keep the dope flowing. And if you get a group of black people that try to stop the goddamn drug trade, they have to worry about not just the gangsters, but the police coming after them. Because that was who the Black Panther Party had to deal with first in Oakland. With the combination of crooked police and drug dealers that they were working with, who were trying to stop them from stopping the drug trade. This is why when he lost his mind by this goddamn point. But the co-founder of the I'm not talking about Bobby Seale, I'm talking about his homie, because I can't remember his name right now, and forgive me, my man, please, for that. But he was talking about taking over the crack trade in Oakland, because he understood that the crack trade was basically what was keeping the community down, right? I mean, he also got hooked on crack by this point. But he figured that if they could control the crack trade, that way they could ease the police out and then ease the drugs out. And see, that's the connection that nobody's making. How are they able to have that type of weaponry? Like I said, you know, the English news finds them, the European news services find these cats all the time. The police say that they can't find them. But journalists seem to be able to find these gang members who are willing to sit there and put on, you know, a mask or a bandana, baklava, and, you know, spill their guts about what they do, how much dope they push, and no one seems to do anything about this. And the black community is silent about it, too, because, you know, one, nobody wants to come down on black men all the time, you know, because they're already coming down on them, right? But at the same time, they also live in fear of these armed groups. And open carry is out here talking this nonsense. This is a really bad alchemic combination that we're doing here, because nobody really knows how this is going to turn out. And the press is doing their thing, and the Obama administration is trying to be quiet. Because, you know, any time that he says anything, it's going to be, you know, taken completely
right.
out of
the You know, I mean, look at the, and this is not the defend Barack Obama hour, okay? But look back for a moment at what happened when he said, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon.
Yeah, but see, but then again, look at what we're dealing with. Fox News didn't have anything else to say. He took, and again, I'm not a fan of his either, but he tried to make a safe statement. Right, to not offend anybody, and they still took offense to this. You know, so really, you have to be really honest with yourself if you're a listener or, you know, anybody's paying attention to the news. You have to take anything that the conservatives say with a grain of goddamn salt, because they will use anything possible. They'll take this conversation we're having right now and blow it up to we're sitting here trying to edge white people. What was his name? The politician that said there's a war on whites.
Oh, Mo Brooks.
Being led by the Democrats.
Mo Brooks.
Mo Brooks. right?
No, I said, being led by the liberals.
Yeah, he'll say that I'm right, you know, that Mo Brooks is right. You know how I know that? Because I was listening to the Bob Kincaid show. He's out of Appalachia. And, you know, you would think that he would think a little smarter. And he's talking to some crazy-ass black Indian. And they're saying that white people are crazy and that this, you know, they're pushing for a race war. And it's black people that, you know, through not really understanding the system that are kind of helping push this along. And that, you know, such and such and such. It doesn't matter what we say. They will take anything that is said by Barack Obama, who they shouldn't have any problems with. I mean, he's doing everything that they want to do. He's meek. He's scared to say anything. You know, he listens to, you know, whatever lobby, you know, has the money. I mean, we have to understand who put him in office. It was Goldman Sachs. It wasn't us. You know, it wasn't our nickels and dimes that put this man in.
You know, there is. Let me back up for just a second, Angry, and shift gears just a tiny, tiny bit. Yeah, Texas Betsy pointing out, you know, if Barack Obama said good morning, they take it badly, and that's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
If he said this afternoon I discovered a cure for cancer, the right wing would say, yeah, but what about Ebola?
that's true.
If he rescued a kitten from a tree, they would complain that the ladder bit the bark of the tree and had harmed it in saving the cat, and note that the cat was black. Okay? I mean, that's just the reality we live in. But this is interesting. There was a recent survey, and maybe there's some progress being made, Angry. There was a recent survey of U.S. law enforcement agencies across the country. Mm-hmm. And in that survey, the number one terrorist threat that they faced, they mm-hmm. said pretty uniformly, is the sovereign citizen movement.
Mm-hmm. And the piece that I told you I was going to have yesterday will be out tomorrow, and I'm talking about the exact same thing and what happened when that report came out. Now, that's not the first one to talk about this. You can go back to 2007, 2008, 2009, which is the last time I looked, when I saw the publicly available copy, and you can get all of this online now. They've been saying this for a long time. And the Michelle Malkin flipped out the most in 2009 when that report came out. But Napolitano did the last one. And John Boehner had a conniption. And he was upset. This is how he was verklempt, I suppose, that the report had the audacity to say that sovereign citizens, neo-Nazis, Tea Parties, you know, I mean, the extreme right in the United States were terrorists, or were prone to terrorist, you know, activities and actions and so on. And, you know, it's just total denial about what we all know to be obviously goddamn true. You know, I mean, like I said, we're here, you got the Ku Klux Klan now and saying that they're not violent and they never have been violent. What?
Oh, I know. Meanwhile, speaking of sovereign citizens, this happened yesterday. I don't know if you saw this or not. But a guy, Jesus, I mean, you just kind of go, what? This happens in Dallas. And 60-year-old Douglas Le Guin deliberately set fire to a dumpster and then called in a missing persons report.
Oh, yeah.
And when the cops showed up, he started shooting at them. Now, mm-hmm. he is described as wearing a towel or a bandana around his head. I don't know what the purpose of including that in the news report is. Let's see. He set off a smoke bomb during the standoff. He shot some propane tanks during the standoff. And was, in fact, a sovereign citizen.
And they will not profile white males between the ages of 22 and 54.
Or 60, apparently.
Or 60, right? I mean, how old was Von Braun?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know this is a white guy, but odds are 10 to 1? 100 to 1 that he is? And then, of course, there's the Officer Kepler couple from the Tulsa, Oklahoma Police Department who wasted a dark-skinned man for the summary executable crime of dating the white daughter that they had already thrown out of the house.
Threw her out. She met him at the shelter that she was staying at. Mm-hmm. They took a liking to each other. He decided that, you know, he didn't give a damn about her circumstances, that they were going to spend some time and get to know each other, what have you. I guess they actually had been involved for quite a while. Decided to, you know, see her on the street and just hazily.
Yeah, and the young man is walking toward her daddy to introduce himself.
Introduce himself. Like he was, I suppose, taught to. He, from what I understand, he told the father, well, she's safe because she's with me. And then they tried to shoot her as well.
Yeah. And they went and they winged his brother, his 13-year-old brother.
Oh, I see. I didn't know his brother was there. You will. You know, I mean, it's...
Meanwhile, back in Ferguson, angry, this is a dandy, too. A white guy goes, I guess he's doing some disaster tourism, so he decides to roll nice and slow through Ferguson with his video camera running. And in his video, he says, if it was a white person, nobody would care if the cops killed him. And then yells, fuck y'all, to a bunch of black folks. And then hollers, go back to Africa! And because I'm the little history weirdo that I am, you know what the first thing I thought of when I read that go back to Africa line was angry? Mm. The meeting that Frederick Douglass took with Abraham Lincoln upon hearing that Abe thought it would be a real nifty idea to send all the freed Negro slaves back to Africa where they done come from.
Yeah, but
and Frederick Douglass had to sit Abraham Lincoln down and say, I ain't no African. I was born here. I lived here. This is my country, too. I ain't going nowhere. And to his credit, Abraham Lincoln, perhaps apocryphally, replied, now that you put it that way.
Well, yeah, but it didn't stop them sending people to Grenada. It didn't stop them from sending people.
Well, it didn't stop them sponsoring boat rides to Liberia either.
Yeah, well, the whole thing about Liberia, which is what I'm trying to say to a lot of black folks, you got to, you know, look at the devil that you're sitting with, man, because the American Colonization Society, they were using all of that as a plan to take over that part of Africa. And they set up the American-born Africans that they sent back there, well, sent back to that part anyway, because we came from all over. But the point was, they started running roughshod over the people who were already there, and they still do. There's a big difference between, you know, if your genealogy is coming from the slavery period of North America, as opposed to somebody who never left, whose ancestors never left what became Liberia. That was a front. You know, they were saying that they were doing it for black people. They were really doing it for the business concerns that were paying for it.
And it continues as a thread through history. Where, come on now, where did Marion Robertson, Pat Robertson, have gold mining interests?
Gold mining, yeah. His Scottish bank account was using, what was it, Feed the Children or something like that to smuggle diamonds out of Africa, you know. I mean, he was doing this for quite a while. But, you know, there's been allegations that most of these Christian organizations have done that, you know. It's not uncommon. Oh, by the way, this is coming across the Twitters. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon will attend tonight's meeting at Christ the King in Missouri about the Mike Brown case. It's going to be a community meeting this evening. I don't know all of the details, but if you look around on Twitter, I suppose you'll find out what's going on. So I suppose that's a slightly progressive thing.
Well, he's a Democrat, isn't he?
Well, what does that mean?
Oh, I know. It means that there is a slightly greater chance than nil that the guy might have some degree of sympathy, if not empathy, with what's going on.
Well, to the degree, and I'm being straight up about this, to the degree that it will get him elected this next round, or whatever they do to try to help get Hillary in here.
Yeah, but, you know, no. Governor Nixon could screw this up as easily as get it right. I mean,
hell yeah.
I mean,
this is so tense.
You're there at Christ the King Church, and you step up into the pulpit and say, I know how you people feel. You know, you lost.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it could happen. Maybe it won't happen.
If I had a son, he wouldn't look like Mike Brown. Yeah, no.
Well, look, as long as he's sincere and if he doesn't talk too much, you know, and as he listens to what people have to say.
There. That. If he goes there and doesn't say a damn thing and says, y'all tell me.
Yeah. Well, see, you're talking about the Assailant Institute, you know, and that's over. And even then, that didn't work, you know, because when they came in, you know, they had this idea that they were coming to save people, right? And it completely didn't work out. So if he can avoid that too, you know, that would be a great help. I know the NAACP is going to be there, and all I can say is, you know, I hope they do their job.
Yeah, it's, well.
You know, I really do. But, yeah, man, you know, I mean, Bob, you know, I appreciate you. And I'm not just saying this because, you know, I like you and listen to the show. I mean, you are, and like I said, I mentioned Mike Malloy, too, for the same reason. I mean, you're the only two white people. You might have Norman Goldman and a couple other folks that actually talk about racism. And when I say that, you talk about it. Not just, oh, yeah, it's bad and. We need to talk and, you know, we this, that, and the other. No, we need to get down to the emotional. No, we need to get down to the emotional nuts and bolts of really admitting that emotions are what is making this a problem. That emotions really have a lot to do with this not being dealt with because we're not thinking.
But it's so far past emotionalism, Angry. It is a fundamental lack of teaching and learning. I mean, I'm not sitting here saying I'm not. You know, there's a lot of people. Malloy ain't one. Rick Smith is not one. Dr. Bill is not one. But there are people who do this trade, this craft, this art from our side of the aisle who spend a lot of time. I don't know if it's from insecurity or what. But making sure that everybody understands how goddamn smart they are. You know, look at me. Look at this daggum law degree I've got. My God, I impress me. I'm intelligent. But all that does is put people off. You know, trying to be an authority instead of trying to engage in dialogue is a loser in my book. And as a consequence of that. You know what I try to do, and what you know, and Malloy is the godfather. I mean, he is the godfather of liberal talk, and or progressive or whatever we call ourselves these days. Yeah. I'm just so sick of the labels, and you know, one of these days somebody should acknowledge that. You know, besides you know us in this little Horn family commune congregation, man's been out there doing it. Before just about anybody else was from this side of the spectrum. But anyway,
yeah, I mean you. Yeah, I disagree with him, too, you know, about things. But, you know, it's like, you know, we're on the same side of the fence, though. But the fact that he has been, you know, still kicking it after losing all of those station jobs for saying what we're saying on this program.
Yeah.
He talked about Israel and got bounced from a lot of places.
Well, you know? and the larger point that I was trying to get to is, you know, we can't talk about race in this country. Well, okay, I don't even like that word because that's a bullshit word. Race is a bullshit word.
Yeah, but that's the word we're stuck with, though.
We can't talk about ethnic crimes. We can't talk about the kidnapping of millions and the killing of millions more. We can't talk about it with any degree of authenticity because most of us don't know that much about it. I was thinking earlier today because I think these weird little things. It was a couple of years ago that for the first time in my life I went down to Selma. I grew up in Alabama, but I'd never been to Selma. And it was middle of June. And I made a side trip out to the second capital of the state of Alabama, little place called Cahaba. It isn't there anymore. But in the middle of the June, I felt that mid-June humid central Alabama heat beating down on me. And the first thing I thought of, man, I wasn't thinking about old Mars sitting on the porch drinking lemonade. I was thinking about people out in the fields chopping cotton in that heat. And that in itself is hell on earth. But then along the way, that area, if we can just play fun with history for a moment, Angry, that area is a sort of ecologically fascinating area. Very few people know that it is ecologically a short grass prairie. And somewhere around there, probably not far from Selma itself, but as yet undiscovered, people have been looking for 400 years, is the site of a place called Malbila. And Malbila was the place where a leader named Tosgaloza gathered his forces together and said, we're going to stop this guy marching through here now. If we don't, we're all done. And at Malbila, and the genius of it was they built an entire city that looked like a native city that wasn't. They threw it together as soon as they heard he was coming. And sent emissaries saying, oh, yeah, yeah, we'll feed you. Yeah, you can rest. Yeah, hey, we're nice. And gave them directions to this new city. And they almost got the job done. Because they knew that these Spanish colonialists were trouble. Because everybody who had come in contact with them got dead. Either through disease or outright murder. Mm-hmm. And as the De Soto expedition approached Malbila, having had contact with other native communities, they were weary, footsore, tired, badly in need of provisions, and hoping maybe somebody would tell them where that city made of solid gold was. Because everybody kept telling them, oh, yeah, city made of gold? Oh, been there a million times. Gonna blow your mind. It's about that way. You better leave now. It's a long way. The sooner you leave, the better. But they show up in front of the walls of Malbila, and they're about to get suckered in when they realize that the one thing they don't see is the one thing that they have seen everywhere they've been. And that is happy little children running all over, and songs being sung, and the smoke of cooking fires, and women going about their business, and men, and no, none of that was there. And that's when De Soto looks up and goes, boys, we got a problem. And the Battle of Malbila transpired, and blood soaked the ground of that short grass prairie. And inside of 100 years, the natives would largely be pushed away off their land, and that land would begin to be cultivated 100, 150 years later by imported kidnapped Africans. And that's the beginnings of white settlement of this continent. And the question that I have to ask coming out of this, Angry, is how can you have a beginning like that and expect anything other than trouble upon trouble upon trouble upon trouble?
I don't think you can. And, you know, in most of my essays, when I've been criticized for what sounds like I believe in nonviolence as
me
a principle.
Too.
I do. I'm not a pacifist. I am somewhat, but you know, I believe in self-defense. You have a right to defend yourself and your community. But the thing about it is, when you talk about the beginnings of the United States, you know, supposedly the U.S. Army was created to defend against the Native Americans that were already here. Right, so it was never, you know, looked at as a takeover. It was always looked at, well, we've always had a right to be here. We just ended up here. The rest of the world just has to deal with it, and we have to make these concessions in our idea, you know, in our idealisms, in order to make this work.
I mean, it hasn't been anything but trouble. Another one of those August 12th things that happened, 1676. a little dust up called King Philip's War.
War.
Came to a close. It came to a close because on August the 12th, 1676, a man named Praying Indian John Alderman shot and killed Mattakamet, the Wampanoag war chief. And that was another end of things moment in that neck of the woods.
Well, as I said, you bring up history that no one wants to deal with. Israelis do not like to talk about how the State of Israel was founded, either in 1947 or when they, you know, were part of the Canaanite genocide. No one wants to discuss that. They'll mention the Bible up and down or talk about it, but no one wants to talk about that.
Oh, hey, by the way, that Battle of Ashkelon, you might find this ironic, if nothing else. The Battle of Ashkelon proceeded when the Native Resistance Army, which was on the march toward Jerusalem, which was held only tenuously by the Crusaders at that point, they started shooting arrows at the Crusaders. The Crusaders responded by marching in bodily and forcefully and just stomping the shit out of everybody. That's how the Battle of Ashkelon went down.
Well, it was siege warfare for how long? In just about all of those crusades, you had siege warfare.
Oh, yeah, the siege warfare was a preferred European tactic. I mean, if it works at a castle in the Loire Valley, well, surely to goodness it'll work in the Levant. Also on this date, August 12th, 1898, an armistice was signed that went into effect that ended the Spanish-American War, and by roughly this time, by this same day, 16 years later, well, you know what was going on. That didn't last long.
What, Philippine-American War?
The Spanish-American War, such as it was.
Well, the Philippine-American War followed right after that.
Yeah,
and almost nobody remembers that one.
No, that was a different no. That was the thing that prompted Mark Twain to write the War Prayer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Rudyard Kipling with his White Man's Burden. Yeah.
Oh, brother. What a merry little chase we've led up and down the annals of history.
Yeah, but like I said, these are things that everybody who's gone to school, every literate person in North America should be aware of. And the majority of us are not aware of these things. So when we have these conversations, they stop at slavery. They stop at lynching. They'll stop at, Emmett Till, right? And we'll center things on Emmett Till. And then we'll talk about the Loving case and how that, you know, just totally wiped away all of the hate from everything else that was being discussed. And then we'll bring up MLK, and then everyone will have Kool-Aid, and then we'll just forget about it and move on to the next thing about worrying about whether or not Kim Kardashian's ass is real. I mean, this is pretty much how things are. You know, you're talking about stuff that has to put the average person in the United States, whether they're immigrant, been here a hell of a long time, or indigenous, into a space where how the hell do we get from point A to point Z? And if you look at the violence that was at, just like every other state, I mean, all states basically are the results of conflicts. You know, the idea that, you know, especially in terms of Europe, right? You know, it's conflict up and down. And usually when you have conflict, when you have domination systems and people being exploited, that involves violence. But nobody wants to say to themselves, wow, I'm acting like a Nazi today. I really need to stop that. No, you know, it takes a certain amount of goddamn pressure, either from the outside, or just overwhelming pressure from the inside of a group that, you know, to the point where you make oppression against them too costly, usually in terms of treasury, because they don't give a damn about their own populations. You know, France left Algeria and Vietnam because they couldn't afford it anymore. They couldn't afford it anymore. Same thing with civil rights here. The only reason the civil rights movement was able to get anything at all is because Vietnam was going on.
Look, Britain really couldn't afford India anymore either.
And no, see, they couldn't.
And that's the thing with liberation movements, whether it be India from the British, Algeria from the French, and of course that was a brutal, bloody, bloody undertaking. The civil rights struggle, which was bloody in its own right here. The only way that those things work, and I go back to echo, Angry, what you said about being nonviolent. I am to my core, and a long way toward being a pacifist, but not all the way. I'm not going to stand around while somebody hurts my family.
Yeah, but see, but here's the thing, though. Now, while I say nonviolence, just one sec. Just now in the United States, if you're a black man or a Mexican, and you put your arms up to protect yourself from being hit, I'm not talking about trying to strike the officer. I'm just talking about trying to protect your skull. That is considered, you know, an assault.
Yeah, a violent response. Absolutely. Absolutely.
A violent response. And that's nonviolence.
But right? but the thing is, nonviolence only works when the oppressing power can be shamed into stopping. The greatest power that nonviolence has is shame.
But see, we don't see any shame in Israel, and we don't see any shame in the police departments here.
And there's no shame in ISIS, ISIL.
No, they don't care. They don't care. They're going after the Christians. They're going after anybody that doesn't believe in their particular form of Islam, which in this case is Sunni, right? But you and I both know that this is a reaction of what the hell was happening before. The rift between Shia and Sunni, the sectarian rift, which the U.S. and British came in and exacerbated.
Exploited.
Totally. There were sectarian killings all over Iraq, and nothing was done about it. You know, nothing was done about it. They were killing homosexuals in Iraq, and nothing was done about it. Nothing was done about it. I didn't even know that they had an open gay community in Iraq under Saddam, but evidently they did. But after the everything switched over, those people were removed.
Well, I mean, why do you think the Reagan administration was so over the moon to do business with Saddam? Why do you think Don Rumsfeld is in that photograph shaking Saddam's hand, grinning like a fox eating shit out of a wire brush?
Yeah, but how many Republicans will tell you that that never happened? The same thing with that photograph of Noriega and Pappy Bush, right? Right? They never met. It never happened.
Those bloodthirsty bastards will get in bed with anybody.
Anybody. Come on, what happened during Iran-Contra? You remember as well as I do. I was really earning my political wings at this point.
And no,
I remember, I can't remember who it was, but he said to the committee that he didn't see a problem with making a living, the money that they were siphoning off of these sales and the money they were making from selling dope, right? Because you remember Barry Seal, that name, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, here it is. He tells the government, a representative of this government, I don't see a problem with pushing democracy in South America, I'm paraphrasing, and making a profit at the same time.
Well, you talk about cutting your political teeth. Who was
one? Was it Secord that said that?
Might have been. Who was Adolfo? Here's a blast from your past. Do you remember the name Adolfo Calero?
Sounds familiar, but I can't make a connection.
He was the Coca-Cola bottler who later became, for Manawa, who later became a leader and primary conduit for finances to the Contra freedom fighters.
Well, so was Citibank, right?
But work with me. So when I was just a little bitty baby journalist, working the editorial desk at CNN Radio, and by that I mean I spent a big part of my shift calling up newsmakers and doing recorded conversations and cutting it into sound bites. Mm-hmm. I was an editor. I got Adolfo Calero on the phone one day because it's, you know, hi, I'm from CNN, and, you know, we'd like to talk to you on the record. And on the record and off the record really does mean something.
Mean something, yeah.
Okay, so when I said, okay, tape is rolling, we are on the record, I sat there and talked to Contra freedom fighter leader Adolfo Calero for 15 or 20 minutes. you know, making notes along the way. At this time, he says this, you know, he says this at this time, and plotting out the little no longer than 25-second sound bites that I'm going to cut out of it. And so then I thanked him and went off the and said, okay, the tape has stopped. We're off the record. Can I ask you a question off the record, Mr. Calero? He said, certainly. I said, you know in this country that, because the political conventions were about to start, you know in this country that a big question is whether or not George Bush knew anything about the diversion of funds to the Contras. He said, and he said, yes, of course I do.
I got one for you.
And I said, and then I said, well, Mr. Calero, did he? He said, my friend, the man was head of the CIA. What do you think as a journalist?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, let's talk about journalism. The guy that started CBS News, I can't remember his name right now, he's on the record, said that he wouldn't name the other journalist. Just like what you talked about, off the record, right? Asked President Nixon, what do you think really happened with JFK? He said, you don't know and you don't want to know. And this is before people knew about Operation 40 and all of the other background behind that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a whole other world going out there that we are not privy to. And it's not the Illuminati.
No, or the Bilderbergs, or
well, they're part of it, but not the way that these cats think.
No, you know, and where's the place where they have sex with naked little boys in the woods in California?
Alex Jones, he claims to have invaded that.
That feeds into my paranoia. All this stuff that's out there, that get, you know, the Illuminati and all of that, it gets such easy traction. I can't help but think that if I was just a CIA analyst with a little too much time on my hands, I'd just sit around cranking this stuff out for the shits and giggles of it.
What makes you think they don't?
See?
What makes you think they don't? You know how many Twitter accounts are not real? Supposedly it's in the millions. I saw a note about it today. Supposedly it's in the millions. I have gotten into arguments with, I know that they were bots, that these were canned responses. This person wasn't really responding to me. They go out there to fish.
Oh, the number. The number of bots that are out there in any time you say anything about the NRA, about guns, whatever, you know, every now and then I've got this new thing that I do. Every time some baby gets murdered, I'll post a tweet that says, as a quote, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of 3-year-olds and mommies," or whatever is applicable, and then I'll use the hashtag gun sense. And immediately, they come flying out of the woodwork like cockroaches with the lights off. And then if you take a look at them real quick, they're goddamn bots.
They're bots, yeah.
Bohemian Grove, that's where we are. Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Oh, and by the way,
I didn't even want to say it.
By the way, got to get out of here angry, but one last thing to mention. Lauren Bacall has passed away.
What, today?
Yeah, just recently it was announced. 89 years old. Oh. 89 years old, the widow of Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah.
And a life well lived.
Well, I mean, her type of lady doesn't exist anymore, you know? I mean, that era of glamour, of that level of class and independence, female independence in terms of thinking, for her time period, she was very unique.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Her and Katharine Hepburn were very unique. Yes, sad news. But anyway, my brother, you be cool.
Thank you, Angry, for a delightful conversation. I appreciate it. It was heavy stuff, but you engage in it with the professionalism of the professional that you are. So I thank you.
Well, thank you. I try. And please, somebody send Bob the $7 he needs.
No, we got to say, no, we're over the hump. Now, we'll start tomorrow. Paul from Parts Unknown's challenge has already been answered by John. So tomorrow all we got to do is raise $150, and we'll be caught up for the week.
All right, good luck with that, and good night, my man.
Peace. All right, thanks, Angry. Bye now.
All right.
The Angry Indian. Catch his radio program, by all means. Hey, time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody. Have a wonderful evening. Gina, it's all for you.